Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
What you saw in the Iran-Contra hearings was the exposure of the beginnings of a national security state, which believes it has the right to override the Constitution of the United States in the name of security.
I think that there was a substantial shadow government trying to run foreign affairs for the United States.
In any other country, it would have been called a coup. And they seem to have gotten away with it.
Modern-day pirates, these guys, they have escaped essentially the control of national governments, but they're available for use by national governments. Sometimes they move under color of, and defend themselves as advancing U.S. national interests in this. But I think that's very secondary with these guys. They're out to make a buck.
I did do it. I am not, as I said in my statement, at all ashamed of any of the things that I did. I was given a mission, and I tried to carry it out.
The Iran-Contra hearings.
On September 1st, 1987, S. Brian Wilson began a protest at the Concord Naval Weapons Station near Oakland, California. That's one of the places that send out the weapons that have killed or injured tens of thousands of people in Central America. Brian delivered a letter to the base commander telling him that on that day he'd begin using his body to block the trains carrying those weapons. His hope was that if they stopped the train to save one human life, they were not far from understanding they could also stop it from destroying many human lives, each of equal value in Central America. They must have known he meant business. 1 year earlier, with three other veterans, he'd gone without food for 36 days on the steps of the Capitol to persuade Congress to stop the killing in Central America. Brian Wilson, former high school jock, former Air Force security officer in Vietnam, former dairy farmer who'd received a commendation for his work with the traumatized veterans of Vietnam, was run over that day. He'd put himself in the place of the people of Central America, and in doing so, he opened up the deepest truths of human existence. For the life and times of Brian Wilson had turned him into a satyagrahi, a practitioner of the nonviolent resistance to evil. The path taken by Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, and Archbishop Romero of El Salvador. Brian trusted that even greater than the power of a speeding train is the power of truth and love. He showed a new kind of heroism, the kind that may just bring the world back from the brink of self-destruction. He acted on his faith in the unity and sanctity of all life, and that if one person will speak and act upon this truth, it will open the hearts of many and provide us a way out in this most desperate moment.
5% of the people of the world live in the United States, but we consume 40% of the resources of the world. We have become used to thinking that we have a right to all that we have, no matter what damage we do to the earth or to other people. We have become detached and disconnected from reality. We have become detached from the earth. We have become detached from the feelings and lives of people elsewhere if it interferes with our right to maintain our lifestyle and standard of living. I would submit to you that we're on a course leading to inevitable annihilation. Martin Luther King said, the issue is not between violence and nonviolence, it's between nonviolence and non-existence. The course we're on in the first world is a course of ultimate destruction. Do we want to be part of this course of ultimate destruction, or do we want to be part of hope and affirmation and justice for all people of the earth and for the earth itself, without which we cannot live? Yes, I'm talking about a nonviolent revolution of consciousness. A consciousness that is able to understand how we're all inextricably connected to each other on this earth and to the earth itself. And that if we violate those fundamental principles, we do so at our own peril. Yes, we can continue to live in this delusion and the denials of reality because it's painful. It's frightening. Sometimes it's terrifying. Just as Vietnam vets have understood, it's terrifying to face the truth, especially when you don't have anybody to talk to. How can we continue as a civilization of we the people if we have to do it at the expense of maiming and murder of people all over the world, whether it's in Angola or El Salvador or Guatemala or Nicaragua or Cambodia or Vietnam or South Africa? Are we going to watch this happen again? Do we just go about our business as usual and know that another 5,000 people will be killed in our name? Or do we have to think about a paradigm shift that somehow is able to experience the anguish of the earth and the anguish of the Nicaraguans and the anguish of the El Salvadorans, whose lives are being threatened by our guns and our money because we have to protect our national security? Well, I hope and I challenge all of you to think, but more importantly to feel in your heart, how you might be able to act in such a way so that the world can live in peace and justice. And I'm liberated. I'm free to stand anywhere, any place, and tell them they cannot continue to kill mothers and fathers and children in my name as a citizen of the United States. So I ask each of you to search your hearts as to what your truth is for being a citizen of the earth, promoting justice as a foundation for peace. It's not going to happen magically, and I think it's not going to happen by relying on these political structures and institutions in Washington. I think we're going to have to wage peace in the most extraordinary ways, whether our government wants it or not. And so I simply say that you will know in your heart, I believe, what to do. But I know that without a nonviolent revolution of consciousness, we will not survive as a civilization or as a planet. We are at an extraordinary point in history where we can choose to have peace if we want to pay the price. And what more glorious goal and value do we want than peace for all people? And so I look forward to working together with you all, with we the people, to build a new society, a society that understands that we are not worth more and they are not worth less, and that we will be willing to pay the price and take the risks to wage peace with all fellow and sister human beings.
There is a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life and relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein over 1,000 thinkers from all over the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, wherein we individually sharpen our intellectual self-defense skills by practicing the universal arts of liberation. Also in the notes for this episode, if you're interested in helping us continue producing the highest quality publications, there's a donation button. In fact, there's many donation buttons all over the site and in the notes. For The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which is our new multi-DVD interview project currently in post-production. With over 5 hours of interview footage, this is a collection of education which is truly invaluable. Those who donate $50 or more towards the completion of this project will receive the entire DVD set as our way of saying thanks. This episode's update on the Gatto DVD set is that we've successfully test-burned the rough cut versions to Blu-ray, and now we're working on sound mastering, introduction, titles, and the actual publication and printing of the DVDs. So it'll be at least another 2 weeks, but the end result is worth the wait, and judging from the responses we've had from early screenings of the rough cut, everyone's expectations should be met. The standard definition set will be 4 DVDs, and the Blu-ray will likely be 2 25-gigabyte Blu-ray discs or 1 50-gigabyte Blu-ray disc. The interview itself is transformational, to say the least, and it's a perfect piece of media to bridge the gap between what you know and those you're trying to communicate with. And since most people go to public schools, we all have some important history to learn in order to unschool our minds and truly become educated in reality. If, after listening to today's episode and clicking your way through the notes, you'd like to know more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts, including Media Monarchy, Corbett Report, Gnostic Media, The School Sucks Podcast, and Remedy Radio, all of which lead by example and are likewise commercial-free and funded by those who find their media to be of value in today's world. Today's episode is a lesson in how the world really works in terms of foreign and domestic policy. And in order to understand the nature of such ideas, it is essential to study the primary documents and artifacts. But in order to get to the point where you're ready to study the primary documents and understand what the artifacts mean, you must first become aware of the subject or topic and be introduced to it. And from there, you might watch a few videos or listen to some audio lectures, and then you're ready for some secondary sources, which result from others who have academically studied the primary sources. Once you've conducted those steps, then from there, you're now ready to delve into the primary sources, as such distractions as the social idiom of the time or language barriers or mistranslated passages won't then infringe upon your ability to understand the context from which history is woven. Now that we have an idea of the various layers of understanding that come together from first awareness of a topic or subject all the way down through the primary sources and back up to communicating to others, in this episode, in other words, will be an introduction, and from here you'll have access to the interviews, books, secondary and primary sources, for that is your journey to start after each episode ends. And my role is simply to make you aware of such topics and to provide easy access to the evidence and artifacts which relate to your eventual understanding. So if listening to this episode does anything constructive, it should lead you to start down the path of comprehensive inquiry into the world around you using a methodology which is repeatable and delivers consistent results. In order to demonstrate what I'm talking about, I'll be calling upon an author named L. Fletcher Prouty, who, among his list of accomplishments, served as Chief of Special Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President John F. Kennedy. Prouty, who is a former colonel in the United States Air Force, retired from military service to become a banker and subsequently became a critic of U.S. foreign policy, particularly the covert activities of the Central Intelligence Agency, about which he had considerable insider knowledge. Prouty was the person who inspired the character Mr. X in Oliver Stone's movie JFK. On another note, in an article published by NPR, fact-checking the Church of Scientology, Prouty told Scientology leaders that L. Ron Hubbard's military discharge papers were, quote, sheep-dipped, meaning two sets of government records were created documenting Hubbard's service, a claim that came to light when Lawrence Wright's expose on the subject revealed that official government documents contained no mention of injury suffered by Hubbard during his service. Injuries Hubbard claimed later were healed through his proprietary Dianetics technology. Prouty's assertion is of particular importance to Scientologists, for if there had been no injury to Hubbard, a cure of such injuries by use of Dianetics would have been impossible, and thus the founding claim of Scientology would be undermined. However, today's interview with Colonel Prouty is not focused on Scientology or the CIA, but with the echelons of power above such groups. And in this discussion titled, The High Cabal, Colonel Prouty lays out the history of America's roots, and when you understand the history, events such as the assassination of John F. Kennedy are able to be viewed with a much more clear focus. After Colonel Prouty is done, I'll be featuring the audio from a video, which is available on YouTube, titled, What I Learned About U.S. Foreign Policy. The audio from which will also teach you quite a bit about how American domestic policies are formed and how this affects America's foreign policy and its actions around the world. And I guarantee that if you take the time to listen to the words of Colonel Prouty and to consider the ideas expressed in What I Learned in U.S. Foreign Policy, that you won't find what they teach in public school civics classes, but rather a reflection of how the world really works in actual and factual history. And it's only in understanding the history and observing how things work that we can learn from what we don't like and improve and evolve it into what makes us all smile. There can be pride in a job well done, but only when it doesn't violate the volition of others. This is episode 38, The High Cabal, Lessons in Foreign and Domestic Policy. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
This whole indication of much higher or more powerful forces at play to lay things like this down and have the planted stories ready to go before the actual events themselves transpired certainly does indicate some form or level of tremendously powerful influences or interests behind the scenes, powerful in fact mostly because of their invisibility, because it's so hard to pin them down, to point at any group or interest that could be a likely candidate for a lot of this type of organization, planning, and real-time releasing of false stories or whatever else to paint the stories that then became the truth. You speak in the Saigon Solution articles to soon become a book about this high cabal. Others have called them the power control group or the cryptocracy. This group that people like Buckminster Fuller and Winston Churchill have referred to as existing and as very real and influential, largely behind the scenes. We were discussing the other day the significance of the philosophy that derived from knowing that the world was finite with the explorations of Magellan, who wanted to keep going west to see what he would find, and how such knowledge formed institutions like the Haileybury College and then the Far East, the British Indies, Far East Trade Company. Can you sort of reiterate that marvelous description, your sense of this changing worldview once it was known that the world was no longer flat, that it was a closed unit?
You know, there's no shortage of experienced writers who, for various reasons, allude repeatedly to, I like Churchill's term better, a high cabal. This is attributed to Churchill by Lord Denning in his very good book, A Family Affair. Lord Denning corresponds to our Chief Justice of Supreme Court, the senior law officer in the United Kingdom. And relating a story about World War II and the heavy bombardment in England and in Europe, he states that his brother, who was an officer with British Naval Intelligence, was working on duty late at night in an underground subterranean area that was between 10 Downing Street and an underground shelter where Churchill used to stay during bombing attacks. So the Navy, being as alert as ever, st- stocked this area where Commander Denning was working with a few high-quality bottles of brandy. And as the Churchill would walk through their office, the commander would invite the Prime Minister to sit down and have a brandy. And he said on many occasions, and particularly one night after there'd been a heavy bombardment on London, and they knew that Rotterdam was under attack, Churchill was sitting there sipping his brandy, and he, almost as if speaking to himself, said, you know, an all-out battle on land, and heavy battles in the sea, and this total bombardment over Rotterdam and over London. He said the high cabal is, you know, operating here. And he referred to this being the wishes of the high cabal. Now, unfortunately, Lord Denning doesn't go any further with the reminiscence of his brother, but maybe they didn't go any further. You know, maybe just Churchill said that much. But I was at the Cairo conference where Churchill was, and I was in his group. I was close enough to at least witness what was going on. I flew the British staff officer back and forth from where they stayed in Palestine during the Cairo conference and talked with him a lot about progress at the conference and all that. And I later was at the Tehran conference where Churchill was. And I lived across the street from Churchill when he was convalescing after these conferences. He had a case of pneumonia in Marrakech in Morocco. Now, I can't say that Churchill was any intimate of mine or otherwise, but at least I was close enough to observe people that worked with him and the military people working with him. I talked with him a lot. And we had the feeling that Churchill certainly is a senior person, as was Roosevelt, as was Stalin, in the world, but that there seems to be a level that maybe he listens to. Maybe this is what Denning was referring to, because Churchill describes a high cabal. Now, he's not the only one. Buckminster Fuller, a rare individual, he has spent more time at the invitation of Congress before congressional hearings than any other individual, with the probable exception of Admiral Rickover, advising Congress on different things in their government. But interestingly enough, he has spent more time in the Kremlin as an advisor to the Soviets than he has in our own Congress. He worked with President Kubitschek in setting up the New Brazil, as a rare individual, a man who knows the world and knows the leaders of the world. He writes about a super elite, that these leaders, as we see them throughout the world, are certainly national leaders, but they're not the top echelon. In history, you will find that the Chinese, as far back as 2,000 years ago, speak of a high cabal, and that the Chinese seem to have accepted that as a regular way of life. And even though they had their emperors and their monarchs and leaders, they realized there's a echelon above there that handles some of these things that even other people. And it's Fuller who hits the nail on the head. He says that the secret of the high cabal is, of course, its control of power, but is its realization that their most valuable asset is anonymity, that nobody can identify them. And in that sense, you begin to think, well, maybe they're just like angels or like ghosts. You know, people say they're there, but, you know, are they really? But I don't think it's that. In fact, I think perhaps that what people think as in terms of ghosts or angels may be the reality that there is an echelon within our world, a small structure that does really determine how things go. And I wouldn't argue the point, because in my own experience in more than 80 countries, and I have talked directly to presidents of countries and things like that, I have this feeling that they're taking their instructions from some other place. Now, that may be personal, but I notice it in other writings. Well, you wonder, what is the source or the origin of this? I don't know how long we want to say mankind have been on Earth, but let's say 30 or 40,000 years. Mm-hmm. Maybe longer in a certain manifestation, but we'll settle for that. Over this 30 or 40,000 years, society has lived on an Earth that wasn't flat, wasn't round. All it was expanse. because there weren't enough people to fill it up at any point. Anyhow, they had no problem with space. They didn't even think about the word property, meaning real property, real estate. They simply lived there. If hostility grew between two communes, two villages, one or the other would be forced to move a little bit. There's always some more space over there. And they weren't bothered with our retroactive view of that, that they had a flat land approach, you know, and that we know the world is round, therefore they were pretty stupid. It wasn't that. It's just that they had another place to go. And if they had to graze more cattle, they'd move a little further. And if one of these moves, they ran into some other people they had never met before, then they accepted there were other people on Earth. But they all on the same expanse. It was they didn't know whether the expanse was flat or curved or what it was. They did know that it came to a shoreline, that there were oceans. And they were prone to follow shorelines, as the South Asians did thousands of years ago as they progressed north across Bering Straits, which at that time was a land bridge, down through North America and even way into Central America. And if you dig in the mummies' tombs and the burial grounds of Peru, you will find huacos, their bowls and jars that they made. And the figures of the people have slant eyes, oriental eyes. I mean, when a person was making the jar, they made the jar in the image of the people that they were, with slanted eyes. They didn't know there were any other people, see? But in all of this civilizing of mankind over these 30 or 40,000 years, there occurred finally an event that changed the entire prospect of their history. And we can't always say, well, they didn't have written history. Evidence from China is that their written history goes way back, far, far back, much more than we think. But that's really not the whole thing. History forms each generation, and they remember the important things. It distills. In the voyages around the world, navigators, especially we think in the area of the islands of the South Pacific and around Indonesia and that area, the navigators begin to be able to find their way across the Pacific to other islands, to other lands, and then back again. The leading, most important people in those countries in those days were the navigators, because they could come and go. They could find their way. They knew the stars is what it amounted to. They understood the winds. And gradually, these navigators began to say that perhaps we could go further around the world and keep going. Well, this became a prospect, something they could do, like we think we can put a man on Mars, and we know we can do it. In Portugal, there was one of these navigators named Magellan. He got in trouble somehow with his own government, or else couldn't be supported by his own government. He went over to Spain. The Spanish king decided he would support his expedition because he wanted to start out going to the west and keep going to the west, which seemed like a good idea. I want to try it anyway. Others had gone to the west, like Columbus, and they hit shore and turned around and came back. Said, we found India, you know, but he had only been part way. But see, he didn't. The people didn't have the idea in those days that they could keep going, except going in a flat way. And when they hit land, they figured they'd been there. They didn't think of the earth in terms of a sphere. And that's quite important. So not only did the royalty of Spain agree to finance Magellan's voyage with several ships, but interestingly enough, the bankers of Antwerp in Belgium poured money into this because they could see it as a means of taking over new lands, new wealth, gold, tin, silver, and all that spices and that sort of thing. So they financed his trip, and three ships took off. Years later, in a harbor back in Spain, one little ship came into the harbor, the Victoria. And the Victoria landed, and they reported how Magellan was killed while they were at the Philippines, but they had discovered new territories all the way around, and that they had gone west all the time and had completely circumnavigated, which must be a globe around. Well, now there's one thing about a sphere that everybody knows. Its surface is finite. If you have a basketball, you can measure to the nth degree how much surface it has. And if you have an 8,000-mile diameter globe, you can measure to the degree how much surface it has. This realization, I think, changed the minds of man as a group more than any other single thing that happened in the 40,000 years we've been here, because from that moment on, these bankers in Antwerp and their associates and the kings and queens of Europe began to realize if this thing is a sphere, it is then finite. And if it's finite, there's only so much land, there's only so much tin, so much gold, so much spice, and this. And they looked at the world as something that belonged to them if they got there first. This started a really unusual train of thought in the educated, financial, politically powerful groups of the world, particularly the European world. And it is expressed most easily in the terms of the East India Company development. They had the British East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, there were Spanish East India, I think there were eight of them. And interestingly enough, there was a Russian East India Company. I forgot what they called it, but the Russians explored the coast of Alaska and California. The Russians, in conjunction with shippers from Boston in the China trade, carried out a sea otter business in the fur of sea otters from California back to Canton, China, and on into Europe, and was one of the most valuable, one of the most profitable sea ventures of the time. So all of these countries were doing this together. They all immediately set out to explore the world, to inventory it, and to own it. Well, the leaders in this were the British, and the British East India Company became dominant in this worldwide exploration. And they achieved this dominance by their view that anything they discovered was theirs, and that the king could commission them to set up a proprietary colony wherever they discovered, a British proprietary colony. And what's meant by that was that they could introduce their religion to the colony and their armies to the colony, and then do business in the colony. And colony, even there, was a not exactly an accurate word, because they used everything from total slaughter of the people they ran into to total friendship, dipped into how they got along with those people. But the idea was that that whatever part of the world they went to was theirs. Property for the other guy was zero, and property for them was total. I said that in an earlier day, the navigators were the senior, the elite people in the country. The elite people now became surveyors. What was, if we think of history in that period, we ask ourselves, what was George Washington's business here in the United States? He was a trained surveyor, and he worked for Lord Fairfax and other landowners solely because the king had granted them a charter from London to come to North America and take over land between one fix on the beach and another, and then have men like George Washington with their surveying instruments just draw lines heading for the west, not knowing where the Pacific Ocean was, but going in that direction. You see, the concept that everything in the world belonged to the East India Company, or to the King of England, or the King of Holland, or the King of Germany, was really a strange development arising from the realization that the earth was finite, spherical, and therefore finite, and that they must acquire property. Mankind was beginning to learn the concept of the ownership of property. Well, this continued for a century or more, until it became an enormously big business. These East India companies were dominating countries like India, even countries like China. They were dominating North America, and so on, as they moved around the world. But the British, again, led the others in training people for these jobs. And they created a college called Haileybury College, where they not only trained the people in the financial aspects of all this business work all over the world, but in military, special military, you might say. They weren't trained to be world conquerors in the Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar mold. They were trained to run a constabulary, to control these countries they took over, and to help their business partners in the East India Company carry out their business enterprises in those countries. And in addition to that, they trained missionaries, because they soon realized that in the rest of the world, there was, from their point of view, no religion. They were all just pagans. Reminds me of the Vietnam days, that any Vietnamese was mere gook, you know. Well, here these people all the world were mere pagans. And of course, you can't live in a world with pagans. You have to bring your missionaries and convert them to Christianity. So this became a role. And they used to go into these proprietary colonies with their missionary leaders first and try to set up peacefully their arrangements for living with these people, for converting these people, and actually taking over their land and taking over their businesses. And if the missionary half of their business didn't work by itself, because they were overwhelming these people anyway with their strength and their power and their money and their imports, then they would bring in their military. So one way or the other, they just took over land all over the world, took over business, took over people. In the process, their masters, the top people, the governor of the East India Company, realized that what they were really after was to learn what the assets of the entire earth were. And in the most interesting way, they set up an economic department, an economic studies department in the Haileybury College. Now, economics is not an old profession, not an old science, as some people want to call it. And as head of the economics department, they installed a man named Thomas Malthus. And the interesting thing was, Malthus was given the job of inventorying Earth, an absolutely incomprehensible job when you figure that this happened at the turn of the century, about 1805, somewhere in there, and that the East India Company had been started around 1600. So for two centuries, they'd been doing this work, preparing themselves for this business. They'd become an extremely lucrative company, but now they were getting serious. They wanted to inventory Earth, and Malthus was given that job. And as he progressed in this study, Malthus came up with his theory that the world was going to come to an end because mankind was increasing at a geometric rate, and food was increasing at an arithmetic rate, and of course that mankind would overwhelm the prospect of the food quantities and not too far in the future. Well, you see, that was a necessary theory for these people in the East India Company, because as they inventoried Earth, it made it an incentive for them to have the food or to have the resources, and not for the other people. It began to create almost what we have in the Cold War today, an us or them situation. And the more friction there is in the us or them situation, the more motivation there is on your side to get the job done, including armies, missionaries, and all the rest of the powerful tools we have. Well, this moved along for another 30 or 40 years, and among the men that Malthus sent out to help inventory Earth was a man named Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin went chasing little birds and butterflies all over Latin America and everywhere, and he came back, and he began a report that, you know, there's all kinds of things growing in this Earth. And he came back with picture books of all the different birds he found, the fish that he found, and everything else all over the world. And he began to organize the species of the world. And as he began to tell this to his colleagues in the East India Company and at Haileybury, they began to get this idea of, well, what, after all, is the origin of species? Where do they come from, and what keeps them going, and how do we have one species here and another one there? And we know that Darwin wrote this book called The Origin of Species. The interesting thing, he was rather reluctant to write this book. He was a true professional. He saw his business in certain terms, but he knew he hadn't proved about the origin of species. He didn't want to call it origin of species. In fact, I think, if I remember, it's about page 53 before he gets into that part of his book. But it's an interesting thing there. He did proclaim that among all the species, or among the internal groupings within the species, those that were fittest survived, and those that weren't presumably didn't survive. You know, it was It was an interesting thing that he came up with. But thinking of the scenario of the East India Company, these two men played an important role, a very important role for them in their day and for us 150, 200 years later. And the first one is that mankind is increasing too fast and food is going to give out. Secondly, that in the event there is this conflict and that we can't all live, the fittest are going to survive. Well, if you put the two together and think about it, what it means is that if you have the better army, the better business, more power, and your people can conquer the others, even to the point of genocide, that's perfectly all right, because they're going to die anyway, and because they died, they certainly weren't the fittest. We're the fittest. What it did is begin to inculcate into the minds of these leaders, these top leaders, these extremely wealthy people, that there's nothing wrong with genocide. Furthermore, they had their own missionaries right along with them to show that perfectly all right. This was the plan. This is the way the world was made, see? So it's startling to come to the conclusion that the realization that the earth is spherical, therefore finite, then that it needed to be inventoried, that certain powers needed to control all of the property of Earth as we progress through the years. Well, you know, we're talking about days that aren't too far behind us. In all the 30, 40,000 years of mankind, we're only talking about that narrow little space between 1600 and 2000, 400 years. And since new ideas spread very slowly, the first 200 years of that 400 years really don't count for much. Those were the years when they were really exploring, finding the earth they didn't even know existed, getting used to the fact that you could go to the west coast of California from England and so on, and that there was a route you could make the trip. And that took about 200 years. And by the time they got that organized, then they got themselves involved in the Napoleonic Wars of Europe, much of which had to do with this business of conquering earth, inventorying earth. And you're not too far from World War I, and you're not too far from World War II. In other words, what I'm saying is this cycle is not over. We haven't finished the inventory of Earth. We haven't finished who owns what. But we have defined the idea of property. Property now, right down to the last inch. There's no, the middle of Tokyo, and a square foot of ground is selling for thousands of dollars. There were sections of this that are quite interesting. I read in the newspaper not too long ago that some property in Africa had been taken from native groups, and they decided to give some of it back. And the section of that property was called the Jesuit Square. And as I recall what I read, and I wish I had the figures here, I think the Jesuit Square was about 15,000 square miles. In other words, as these missionaries moved ahead on this inventory process and just assumed ownership of this land, they were taking over so much land that 15,000 square miles was just a square, just a square. Like, what do we call a square mile? 640 acres is a square mile, not 1 mile square, isn't it? Well, this figure is the same figure that was used when the Spanish East India Company began to go into what we now call New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California. In the old land titles, it still speaks of Jesuit Square. Mm. You see, this was a formal application of the missionary role on into these so-called unexplored countries. Everything was from the point of view of Europe. The fact that there were hundreds of thousands of people living somewhere, it was called unexplored. They just ignored the fact those people were there. It wasn't explored by British, like the discovery of America. You know, would you keep saying Columbus discovered America and the British explorers and so on, the pilgrims first came to America? My God, America was overrun with people, but the Europeans discovered America. See, that's part of the overwhelming significance of this discovering that the Earth was a sphere. Now, we are living in what might be called the apex of this big curve. It certainly isn't over. We're still operating under the principles of Haileybury College, Malthus, and Darwin, and even though both of them are ridiculous. It's been proved today that our ability to produce food is 70 times greater per farmer than it was in the time of Malthus. It's been proved that Darwin never did discover the origin of a species. No scientist has ever described the origin of any species. But those two doctrines have been implanted on us by the East India Company's mind control techniques so thoroughly that we believe them. And it was in 1862 that Lord Oliphant came back from his job as ambassador to the Ottoman Empire in Turkey, imbued with the spirit that something happens to men's minds in seances. And he created in England the British Society of Psychic Research, which immediately took over most of the higher positions in government. In fact, Lord Balfour, for over 30 years, was either the head of the British Society of Psychic Research or one of his relatives or close associates was. And it's the American wing of the British Society of Psychic Research which created Stanford University, University of Indiana. Leland Stanford, the great railroad man on the West Coast, claims that he was in a seance talking to his dead son when his dead son told him to create a major university on the West Coast, and there we have Stanford University. Well, that's kind of a humorous little story until you put it in this context, that these enormously powerful leaders stemming from the East India Company got into this psychic research arena and even began to impress upon the Society of the United States, South Africa, other parts of the world, their own beliefs in the power of seances, in the power of mind control, and things like that. And just to kind of wind this up with a little anecdote, the governor of the East India Company in Bombay, India, was a man named Elihu Yale, Eli Yale. Yale heard that a small college in New England, specifically Connecticut, was having trouble getting started. He donated something like $10,000, with a lot of money in those days, to help found the college. And we have Yale University, comparable to Harvard University, as a function of a gift from the East India Company, from Yale in Bombay, India. In his offices in Bombay, which still exists, on the wall, there is the flag of the British East India Company. That flag has 7 red bars and 6 white bars. In the corner, it has a blue square. And in that square, or rectangle, is the emblem of the East India Company. When the Bostonians attacked the ship Dartmouth and threw the tea in Boston Harbor at the Boston Tea Party, they took the flag down off the Dartmouth. It was the East India flag with the red and white stripes and the blue rectangle, and they saved it as a memento of that battle. And when George Washington went to Boston to assume command of the armies of the rebellion against England, he asked Betsy Ross to take the emblem off the flag and to put stars. And all Betsy Ross did that night was not create a flag. She simply snipped out the East India emblem, put in 13 little white stars, and the American flag is the East India flag. And when you hear people of what you might call ancestral backgrounds in this country demanding that we pledge allegiance to the flag, you may sometimes wonder if in their seances they don't see the East India flag instead of the American flag as the driving force. It certainly did in the case of Cecil Rhodes, who became the controller of all of the South African area and a multimillionaire in his day. And it was Cecil Rhodes who decided to send emissaries of his own to this country so that he could be sure that the teachings of the East India Company and of Haileybury College and of Malthus and of Darwin would be properly inculcated into the minds of Americans by selecting Rhodes scholars year after year and having them go to British colleges where they could then come back into our society and become leaders of the event. All you have to do is look at the historical record to see that Cecil Rhodes' plans were very well carried out. And Cecil Rhodes, again, was motivated by the same East India Company philosophy that since the world was a sphere, you had to get property. If you were going to get property, you would own the world, and that was their driving force.
pursuing just one more step, this sort of wrapping this all up in the next hour, your last discussions on the British East Indies Indian Trade Company and their type of way of influencing thought, having a very central influence on the way people thought about things or continue to think about things. We were talking about some books the other day. I'd like to just touch on two that seem particularly important. One, you mentioned Peter Drucker, who has since, I guess, become very much synonymous with the idea of management and capitalistic economics of sorts of the of whatever nature. A book he wrote that you pointed me at in 1938 or 1939, the bulk of which he'd written in the early 30s, called The End of Economic Man. Could you talk just a little bit about that?
This is very interesting because most of us know Peter Drucker as an advisor and consultant to the biggest businesses in this country. He's synonymous with big business, with free enterprise, with multinational corporations. And he just has a new book out. And the New York Times scrupulously reviews many of the books he has written and overlooks entirely his first book, which is The End of Economic Man. Peter Drucker, I believe, is an Austrian, schooled in Germany and Austria, who grew up in the years of the growth of the Nazi Party in Germany. And I believe, I'm not absolutely sure, but I believe his family was Jewish. And during that era, as a student in their major universities, he began to put together his idea that this Nazism that was growing under Hitler would destroy forever economic man. And his family left Germany and Austria, as many did, and went to England. And he published this book, The End of Economic Man. His premise, others have made, but I don't think any as clearly as he has, that what the Germans were doing was taking the German society of post-World War I, when most people wanted no more war, and the Germany of the Weimar Republic, reasonably democratic in terms of Germany anyway, and that all of a sudden this Nazism began to turn the German people into various classes of society, like a military structure, captains, majors, colonels, generals, and so on. And that everything in Germany was being militarized. Boy Scouts were militarized. Girl Scouts were militarized. Everything was militarized. And it was all being done with the money and the approval of the very powerful, very wealthy people. Well, he goes into this in great detail. I can't recommend a book higher than that book. Everybody should read it, because he not only says this is what destroyed Germany, but that its replication in any other country, England or the United States, would destroy those countries. And I think anyone who reads The End of Economic Man today is going to think Peter Drucker was writing about, you might say, the last decade of the United States, as though next year was going to be the beginning of American Nazism, or the equal of it. The two things fit hand in glove. But his book was written in 1939, not 1989. However, no one should omit that book. It's most important. And so many things we're doing today appear to be running along that same current. We have war on poverty. We have war in the streets. We have war against AIDS. We have battles of this, and we have everybody carrying automatic weapons up and down the streets. I mean, that's what he was talking about. So read the book.
Militarize even the war on drugs, which seems to threaten so much of our...
Everything is a war. You know, it not just a program, not to try to an anti-drug thing. Everything is a war. As though war was exactly the way thing, as though we ought to organize druggists and policemen and school teachers as majors and colonels and generals, you know, and the students ought to all wear uniforms. This is what it was all about. But I shouldn't talk too much about this because Drucker says it so well. I want you to read Drucker's words and not my copying his words. He does it. He describes it. Really, it becomes frightening when you read the book. There's only one way to think about it.
The other book we discussed was something written by Foster Ray Dulles, one of the Dulles brothers.
No, this is a mystery to me. I have a very good book about the Dulles family that speaks about everybody in the current Dulles family that we know of. You know, John Foster, Alan Dulles, his sister Eleanor, their father and mother and their family and all that sort of thing. This man, Foster Ray, R-H-E-A, Dulles, is not mentioned anywhere. And I have cross-referenced through every book I can locate without, you know, including like Who's Who things and all that, and Writers in America and so on. And I don't find Foster Ray Dulles. Even as a pseudonym, you might say. But Nom de Plume type thing, I don't find that. But the book is remarkable because it is entitled The Road to Tehran. Now, the book was written in either 45 or 46, and Tehran is the Tehran Conference of December 43. So in this writer Dulles' mind, he starts with American history back in the Revolutionary War, shows how closely Americans and Russians were related. For instance, John Quincy Adams was our ambassador, or at least our designate, to the court of Catherine the Great and Alexander and so on back in Russia. They traveled to Leningrad, or then, what, Petrograd then? And their objectives were to open trade between the United States and the Soviet Union. And we did have an elaborate trade system. The shipping interests of Boston were shipping, one of the most important trade routes they had was to the Soviet Union, or to then Russia, just old Mother Russia. And Dulles follows this through in a very interesting section in the book, where the fact that the Russians had moved across the Bering Straits into Alaska, only along the coast. They had no interest, apparently, in Alaska at that time. Down the coast of Western Canada, as it is now, and well down into California. And you know, on the coast of California, you can still see old Russian buildings that are still there in some of the park areas preserved. And what he points out is that the Russians who had come down there were doing exactly as Jacob Astor's people were. They were hunting for fur. And they were becoming as wealthy in their area as Jacob Astor was here in the United States as a great fur trader. Their fur was the sea otter. And interestingly, the Russians who went down the California coast went there by walking, or dog sled and so on, and where their trade was carried out by the shipping firms all the way from Boston. The ships would travel from Boston to the California coast, pick up the sea otter skins by the boatload and move them into the markets of, some markets in Asia and mostly in Europe. And he puts in a book that in one shipload, they would make between $300,000 and $400,000 profit. Well, of course, $300,000 or $400,000 in 1700s, it was the same as tens of millions of dollars today. The interesting thing was that the Americans and the Russians were working in complete harmony. There was no contest between them. The Russians lived on the West Coast. Americans lived and hunted on the West Coast. And they were, for all intents and purposes, friendly. So that our history with the Russians has been friendly for years. He brings this history back into Civil War, when the Russians in the Revolutionary War, when the Russians refused to help the British. They would not provide Cossacks, the cavalry, to help the British against the Americans, which means they were more or less friendly to America. In the Civil War, the same thing. They would not play a role. In fact, the Russians tried to provide equipment to American ships to support the Union forces in the Civil War. And then up to modern times, he has some interesting views of our relationship with Russia at the Bolshevik Revolution initially, and then which was overthrown when Lenin began to take power. But the views, as he presents them as history, don't exactly coincide with this strong communist bias that we've had. Well, of course, remember, he writes this in the 40s when the Soviets were our allies during the war. And as he carries this up to the Tehran conference, he more or less draws the conclusion that the agreements at Tehran were sort of natural agreements, that America and Russia had more frequently been allies or friends or business associates than adversaries. And of course, he leaves the book at 1944. The war ended in 1945, and we had the anti-communist brainwashing era in the late 40s, but that's after his book. So this is a very necessary book for people who want to understand the relationship between our two countries as we come into the present era and begin to understand each other more closely. It's not the equivalent of the book called The Great Conspiracy, written by Alfred Kahn, but it is as important. I think The Great Conspiracy, written by Alfred Kahn, and given a rousing introduction by Senator Pepper in 1946, is an even better explanation of American and Russian interests, with an unusual understanding of the intrigues from England and Germany that were involved in the Bolshevik Revolution and the fighting after that, even to the days after World War One, when we had American troops on, after World War One, we had American troops in Vladivostok and things like that, and what that was all about. If we don't understand these books, The Great Conspiracy or The Road to Tehran, it's very hard to understand this whole era of anti-communism, which was more or less impressed upon the American people. There was no evidence that this was really the state of affairs, except the traditional thing that any group in power in any nation has to have an enemy. And for reasons that are not clearly understood, immediately after World War II, it was decided that we had to have an enemy, and that was communism. And because it was communism, it was Russia, and it was China, without any other definition. That was just it. And then we've been brainwashed since. That may be changing today, it may not be changing, but I think it's changing because we also realize that military-type war is probably outdated now on account of nuclear weapons, and that warfare from here on will be economic warfare. It'll be just as tough, it'll kill just as many people, it'll cost as much money, but it will be economic warfare.
One side question regarding this change, your sense in the change of warfare per se, occurred to me the other day. As you indicated, you feel that the military-industrial complex's influence and pervasiveness will lessen as the new economic warfare intensifies, particularly in the area of energy, as it's currently going now, as well as in the area of food, as you feel will become prevalent. What do you feel will happen with respect to the organization currently in place that you define as the secret team that seems to move in this industry of military defense industry?
I think we've seen an absolutely perfect example of what we're talking about in what is called the Arab oil embargo. You know, in the decade up to 1973, the price of a barrel of oil had been $1.70. And that was more or less worldwide. If you want to buy 100,000 barrels of oil, you paid 100,000 times $1.70, and you got the oil. At that price, oil was profitable. The companies were making enormous profits. The producers, like Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Iran or Russia, were making profits with their oil. And then, all of a sudden, they decided that they were going to increase the price of oil. And by they, I mean the high cabal, the people in great money. It's nothing but a money deal. It's nothing but a war. Like you fight in Vietnam, it's for money and nothing else. We didn't gain a thing except we spent between $250 and $500 billion fighting a war in Vietnam. Overnight, the price of oil went up. There was a battle between the Israelis and the Arabs. The story goes that the Arabs, as a result of that war, declared an embargo on a shipment of oil from Middle East to the rest of the world, and that made the shortage of gasoline in the streets, and we could not get gasoline at our favorite gas pumps, and we had to pay more and more and more. We should look back at that carefully. The Arab-Israeli war was not conclusive. The Arabs gained on the first few days way into Israeli territory, and then a couple of weeks later the Israelis came back and went right away into the Egyptian territory, and then the war just ended. It was inconclusive. But all of a sudden, the Arabs, according to the press, signaled an embargo on oil. Now, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world, because the only income these Arabs have is the sale of oil. And furthermore, the oil that they produce comes from the ground all by itself, under pressure from the earth. They don't have to pump it. They had no great big problem with supplying oil. As a matter of fact, I can show you copies of the Congressional Record in which oil experts from the Middle East reported that exactly at this time of the Arab oil embargo, the storage tanks at the Arab facilities, whether it's Kuwait or Iraq or Saudi Arabia, were overloaded and bursting with oil, waiting for ships to come. A few years later, I was asked, as a representative of the American Railroad System, to attend a conference in London at the Chartered Institute of Transport. And among the seminar groups that I met with there was one on petroleum transportation. A gentleman came into that room and lectured to only eight of us who had come to that class. I'm very glad I went to it. And one of the Englishmen in the room nudged me as the speaker was coming into the room and said, "You know this gentleman?" I said, "No." He said, "This man is a multi-billionaire ship owner." It occurred to me, and has since, why would a multi-billionaire, in pounds, by the way, more than dollars, why would he want to come into a room with eight people and lecture on petroleum transportation? Well, of course, a very good reason. That was all being recorded and would be printed in a book later, and so his words would become part of the record, and he's very proud of what he had been doing. What he told us was the same thing as these people reporting to the Congress, that there was no shortage of oil. What happened was that a very well-planned system was applied through the tanker industry, and they arbitrarily and absolutely controlled the movement of oil by not picking it up until the price was right. Now, in 1973, the Middle East produced and sold $15 billion worth of oil. By 1980, the same Middle East produced and sold $300 billion worth of oil. The quantity of oil they produced was not much different. The cost of producing it was not much different. But the sale price was $15 billion in 73, and 7 years later, it was $300 billion. I think anyone can understand that for $285 billion profit, it's worth doing almost anything in this world today. And that accounts for the Arab oil embargo, the shortage at the fuel pumps, and the fact that we Americans are paying $1.30 a gallon for gas when we used to pay 29 cents a gallon for gas. Well, it's this kind of control that is the new kind of warfare. Now, petroleum is not an absolute necessity of life. Energy is, and petroleum is a major factor in energy. But it is close enough to being a necessity so that this shortage of oil, this control of oil, really hurt people all over the world, and especially in the leading nations like ours, because overnight they increased one of the major expenses we have in the cost of running an automobile. So that this kind of war has as its battlefield the streets of America, with the streets of Paris, the streets of London, where our automobiles are, where our trains run, where our airplanes fly. And it is a completely different battle, but it is a battle for enormous profits and the controls that those profits get. Because once the price of oil goes up, the price of coal goes up, the price of natural gas goes up, the price of food goes up, everything. Because the cost of trucking becomes higher, and most of our food is moved by trucks, so that when the price of oil went up from 30 cents a gallon to $1.50 a gallon, all the rest of the price levels went up on the tide of oil. All escalated with the price of oil. And the cost of just plain living, day by day, escalated with the price of oil. And that price of oil was controlled by superpowers that control those industries. And the catalytic force in that was something as simple as a shipping industry. There is no way to get around the shipping industry. And this is a key. This is what was being explained also as we went to these meetings in London. That traditionally, oil from Iraq, the old oil fields of Kirkuk and Mosul, had traveled through a huge pipeline that went from Iraq through Jordan and to the port of Haifa in what was then Palestine. When the country of Israel was formed, one of the first things the Israelis did, for reasons that are not recorded, is close the pipeline terminus at Haifa. And Iraqi oil could not leave Iraq for the Mediterranean coast and for Europe. Most Iraqi oil is sold and consumed in Europe. Now, there are eight other pipelines that extend from Iraq to the Mediterranean. They go to the port of Sidon in Lebanon and other ports northward all the way up to Syrian ports. So we have seen those pipelines made dry by the Israeli attack on Lebanon. And we wonder why Israel should even bother to attack Lebanon, why Syria should be attacking Lebanon, and why poor old Nutrien Lebanon, which is nothing but the market garden basket of Europe, is brought to its knees by a perpetual war until we realize that that war causes the pipelines from the Middle East to Europe to go dry. Yeah. This forces the oil onto the ships and under the controls that had been devised by the shipping cartels. And this is a fact of life. This is happening right today. The fighting in Lebanon is to keep the pipelines dry. The fighting between the Arabs and the Israelis is to keep the oil pipelines dry. It's not religious. It's not political. The Arabs have no choice. The Israelis receive $2.5-3 billion aid money from us a year, which is perhaps payment for their assistance. The Egyptians receive $2.5-3 billion from us. The most foreign aid money we pay to any countries in the world are to Israel and to Egypt. How does Egypt earn its money? It meters the Suez Canal to oil, and no oil goes through the Suez Canal. So the movement of oil causes the tide of prices to rise all over the world. And part of the device is to keep the pipelines of the Middle East dry. During the Iraq-Iran war, the Iraqis even attempted to build a pipeline through Turkey. And they were forced so much to export oil that they were exporting, I believe, almost 1 million barrels of oil a day by truck through Turkey. Now, that's not profitable. That's a terrible cost for oil. They couldn't get it down the river through Abadan. Their Persian Gulf ports had been destroyed. The Iranians couldn't get oil out of Iran. Their ports had been destroyed. They were bargaining with Turkey to run a pipeline across Turkey out of Iran. And again, billions of dollars being spent on that pipeline, so which raises the price of oil beyond its economic levels. So that the war between Iraq and Iran was simply to create a shortage of oil from those two countries, which would create a higher price because of the lesser amount of oil available around the world. So it's this kind of economic control of a major commodity, oil, that is the new type of warfare between nations on Earth. And we're going to see more of this because it produces such enormous profits. When the Middle East was making $300 billion in 1980 on the oil that it exported, that represented about 40% of the world's total, meaning the rest of the world was selling for maybe $400 billion for its oil. Oil that only 7 years earlier would have sold for $16 to $18 billion. The profits are enormous. They're unbelievable.
I'd like to go back briefly to your mention before of the sense of the high cabal as a unit or group of some form, originating perhaps more from the Oriental base of historical roots than perhaps the Europe base. You were telling me the other day of the story of the Chinese travelers who went to the Middle East to study the knowledge of the Arabic people, and their whole
approach in the way they ran their exploration and your sense behind that to a degree of the high cabal perhaps more originating out of the Oriental basis, of a cultural basis, than the European?
You know, we are so prone to study history in a linear fashion. From the United States, we go back to England, we go back to France and Germany, we go to Rome, we go to Greece, back to the Middle East and Babylon and that sort of thing, and it sort of ends there, as though the world began there. I think if you asked 90 out of 100 Americans where Adam and Eve were born or appeared, they'd say the Middle East, because almost every formal study of history trickles back that way, as though Asia or Russia or Indonesia didn't exist, as though there were no people there. Africa is a great big nothing in terms of history. Just as a little clue there, I was in Kano, in the heart of Nigeria one day, and it happened to be one of their celebration days, and there were black men, leaders of Kano, riding horses with coats of mail, you know, linked mail on the horses, and the men were wearing coats of mail armor, just like the old medieval knights of yore, you know, like King Arthur's men. Well, I asked some of the people standing there as this parade went by, I said, you know, where did these come from? Hollywood or something like that? And they said, no, don't you know? And a very fine young man sat me down and told me that hundreds and hundreds of years before, the remnants of a lost crusade, medieval people from Europe, had wandered into Africa and were defeated and captured, and that these natives had these original old coats of mail for the horses and for the men. Now, that in Nigeria, they never had horses. They wouldn't need coats of mail, or they'd have horses. Well, this proves that in Africa, way back in the time of the Crusades, there were people strong enough to defeat the Crusaders, and also to recognize that the loot they captured from those people were worth keeping as historic evidence. In other words, Africa existed in history. In fact, another thing I learned from this man I was talking with is that their language is the original language of the Rosetta Stone. And the Rosetta Stone, which was used to translate the hieroglyphics of Egypt, had been unfathomable to European scholars until all of a sudden a group of Nigerians traveling in Cairo saw the Rosetta Stone, and although they couldn't read the hieroglyphics, they could read the language on the other side. And they read the language, told the scholars about it, the scholars translated it into English, and then they decoded the hieroglyphics, and that's how they solved the story of the Rosetta Stone. The people from Nigeria had this ancient culture which produced a language which is on the Rosetta Stone, and for centuries nobody could translate the Rosetta Stone, forgetting that the Africans had that history and that culture, and our history books leave them out with a big zero. We don't know anything about Africans in history. Well, this is true even more so, even to a greater degree, when we think about China and India and Indonesia and Southeast Asia. They have ancient history. The history we study through Europe and back to the Middle East runs back, 1,000 years before Christ, 2,000 years before Christ. Easily, the history of India and Southeast Asia goes back 11 or 12,000 years. Easily, the history of Indonesia goes back thousands of years. And the history of China is almost limitless. It is quite obvious that the Chinese culture, to include the manufacture of such things as cast iron, or the ability to print on paper, go back long before such things were even contemplated by anyone in either the Middle East or in India. For reference, I would recommend everyone read and study the books of Dr. Joseph Needham of Cambridge University in England. There's a whole series of books, and they're absolutely indispensable to an understanding of the true history of man on Earth. Well, one of the interesting things about Needham's work and some of the other studies of this, of the Chinese people in those days, was the Chinese had mastered the ability to sail in the oceans, as the Portuguese had later on. And the Chinese would follow the coastline down from China, down around Southeast Asia, down around Malaysia, and back up to the Burmese coast, across the Bay of Bengal to Calcutta, or down the east coast of India, past Ceylon and around the tip of India, and on up to Bombay, and even around to Arabia and East Africa. And the story goes that as the Chinese visited port cities on their trips along, it was like a party. As they pulled into port, they would stand out there and wave banners and hold gifts in their hands. They would sing songs and they would dance. They wouldn't carry firearms. And the people met them the same way. And they were welcome to stay for years or to stay whatever they wanted. And they opened up trade and sailed back and forth between these places until one day they arrived in a certain area of the east coast of Africa and they were treated with hostility. And they found out that's as far as the Portuguese had gotten, coming around from Portugal, around Africa, and using guns every time they went ashore, burning villages, stealing whatever they wanted. And it showed that the Chinese method of exploration had been a party with official ambassadors, with presents for the local rulers and all. And the Portuguese system was to use guns and shoot the people. So we see quite a difference in these cultures. And this has led even to a better understanding of their overland exploration. The Chinese, having this enormous landmass to their west, had the same interest in exploring the west as we did, you know, wondering how far the west went. And the Chinese actually traveled with ambassadors, official people from their government, in parties of 15 or 20 as far as we understand today, like Baghdad. And there, such parties would meet the leaders of Baghdad. They would talk and understand each other. The Chinese seemed to be very adept at languages. And if they didn't know the language, they would sit down and study it and study everything these people had. And there was a very intriguing story of a party that the rulers of China sent back to Baghdad with a very learned leader and some 15 or 20 scholars with him. And he would sit down and listen to the intelligent people of Baghdad as they explained how they did this, how they did, like, arithmetic. The Chinese had not learned the Arabic base for arithmetic that, or for mathematics that spread all over the world. And the Chinese were taking notes in shorthand. And they would listen and take notes in shorthand, and as fast as the Arabs could talk to them, they'd transcribe it. This had been going on for a while meaning years. When another group of Chinese came and reported that the king or the emperor wanted the first group to come back. For some reason, they had to go back. So by this time, this elderly Chinaman had become good friends with the leader in Baghdad, and he said, look, I have to return to my country, but I know there is much that we haven't finished studying. He said, I would like you to give me 7 of your best scholars, each in their own trade, their own specialty, and asked them to dictate to me from their books. And he said, I want to write it down and take this back to my emperor. And the Arab chief said, you mean you are going to write down what 7 men tell you simultaneously? He said, yes. And he did. And after he had been copying for 3 or 4 hours, the chief stopped those people, and then he asked the Chinaman, this man from section 3 over here, read back what he told you. Turned his pages, read it back perfectly. Okay, this man, number 5, read it back. The Chinaman, without fault, had been taking down the shorthand, listening to 7 people simultaneously. I use the figure 7. It might have been 8 or 10. Dr. Needham tells the story with great thoroughness. What this says is that the Chinese had perfected, and we believe today they retained this even more so than they had in those days, the ability to write a shorthand that could translate simultaneous lectures, not just one, and simultaneously probably to the number of 7, 8, or 9. Dr. Needham gives the exact figure because he has seen it done. What this means is that when you put all these together, their culture, their art, their trading, their ability to make cast iron and bronze. They drilled for oil at 2,000 feet using bamboo pipe, things like that. They were not backward people. This, without any question, puts the Chinese at a level in history certainly equal to, but probably higher than, the levels of Europe and the Middle East. Now, when we educate ourselves enough to understand that, and as we've said earlier, when we also understand that leaders of this world recognize a high cabal, I think it is ridiculous, since I myself cannot disbelieve the existence of a high cabal, that the high cabal very probably includes Asians and more probably is led by Asians. Now, I wouldn't argue that. I don't know how to explain it, except if you watch rainfall, you notice it all runs in accordance with gravity. Well, if you study mankind, you notice there is a sort of gravity in the day-to-day world of mankind. And I don't think it is all happenstance. I think that there is direction from, as Churchill says, the high cabal. But I also believe that the high cabal, which can include people from, of course, any region of the world, I don't think they recognize countries. I think the world is just the world for those people. And I believe that it would be strongly manned with Chinese, or even probably led by Chinese.
Fascinating. This last thing, we have about 20 minutes here, is this story you told me first day I got here. I found so fascinating, of yourself in a class of young officers, and this assignment you were given to build a bridge. And I'd like you to just recount that for us.
It has interested me for many decades. This idea of politics and this idea of leadership that is thrust upon us, and whether or not it is really the truly human understanding, definition of leadership. If people are stranded on a desert island, they don't hold an election. They suddenly realize a certain person has a little more experience, a little more gift than the others, and they follow them. The armies of the world are traditionally pretty well trained, pretty well disciplined. And before World War II, we saw in the U.S. Army certain things that I'm afraid we don't see today. It got diluted in the great mass movements of World War II and since. But there were people there who tried to impress upon those of us who had been called in before World War II, when the Army was small. I think the all-up military forces of the United States before World War II, about 116,000, if I remember. And when you figure that 10 million men were flown to Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and at any one time we had as many as 550,000, you can see what I'm talking about, 115,000 in the armed forces with not many people. But they were very skilled. And when a new officer, regardless of age, rank, or so on, was assigned to a division, the Army had a custom of division officer training. And his division officer training was rather unique as we look back today. Although you'll find such training at, like, Harvard Business School or other places where men are taught, you know, how to govern, how to lead people, and so on, how to run a business. One of the things they did that I have never forgotten, because it was so effective, it was just absolutely effective, and what we saw impressed us, was that after this group of about 60 men had been together for a week or so, listening to lectures from some of the old-time colonels and sergeants and warrant officers, one of the courses they taught us, rather superficially, but it was very interesting, was how to put together a trestle bridge. In those days, a trestle bridge in the Army was all prefabricated. The posts that hold it up, the pilings at the side of the river to hold it up, and the planks on the top, and how they fitted together, and the bolts and the nuts and the whole structure is all prefabricated. But, of course, it had to be put together precisely or the thing wouldn't work. And every brook or river isn't the same width, so you had to be able to lengthen the bridge, and sometimes the banks were higher than others, so you had to raise the bridge. And the bridge could do that. The prefab structure was such that it would accomplish that. So after about a week of courses on the trestle bridge, where most of it was where we were taught on paper, and every once in a while they take us out to a shed and show us the pieces that were there, but we had never worked on it, we just knew what they were. One evening, just before sundown, they picked up the whole class, about 60 men, piled us into a couple of army buses, and began driving us somewhere without saying where we were going. We had no idea what we were going to do. And they drove us and drove us, and their only objective was to wait till it was dark, and finally stopped in the countryside somewhere beside a rather large field. And we all got out of the buses, and there was a sergeant who said, "Gentlemen, your client, your exercise for the evening lies in that field. It's a trestle bridge." And we were all with an armored division. He said, "There's two tanks in the field. You're going to build that trestle bridge across a river that is on the other side of this field. You're going to drive the tanks across that bridge, and your dinner for the evening is over there on the other side of the river. You are not to swim over and get dinner. You won't have dinner unless you drive the tanks across the trestle bridge." He said, "Now, I have one more request." He says, "Any of you that people who smoke, I want you to give me your matches, your cigarette lighters. We ought to have no flashlights. Hand it all in right now." And he collected everything. He said, "Anybody wants to light up a cigarette, come see me." And he went over and sat down quietly with another sergeant, never said another word. He didn't say who was in charge. He didn't say, anything. Just walked off. So here's 60 people standing by the side of the road. And he had mentioned trestle bridge. So some of us went out in the grass, and sure enough, we stumbled over a couple of things here and a couple of things there. And they were very neatly packed up. There was no problem with that. And a few others walked over to see what the river looked like. And it would be my estimate that it was about 40 feet across, something like that. And the banks were 7 or 8 feet on either side. And we could see a bonfire on the other side, and a tent was pitched. So we knew that our dinner was over there. Well, nothing happened very quick, except a little commotion, people talking to each other about, how do we get this bridge out there? And then finally, you'd notice three or four men who knew each other would say, "Hey, well, at least we got to get this stuff over to the river. Let's start carrying it over there." And another group would say, "Well, we'll carry these things over there." And gradually some action just sort of came. But then from among the group, all of a sudden one man began to say, "Look, when you're carrying this over, put this here, because this is the piling for the beginning of the bridge. And then look, you five fellas, you swim across, and we'll get the other piling over to you by the river. Wasn't all that deep, we could carry it over there. But you get on the other side, we'll work over there while we're working on this side." And finally, one man was just saying to each group, "Okay, put it here, do this, let's do this." Everybody was cooperating beautifully, there was no problem. And in an unbelievably short time, we had actually got that bridge across the river. We had men beginning to put the paving of the planks on the top, and the cross beams that hold those planks, and the bolts to tighten them down. And gradually we walked men carrying the planks across the bridge, and it held them up fine. And we got the planks down, and we got more men going across with other things. And finally, this man who had been more or less leading these just nondescript people, there were chaplains there, there were doctors there, we weren't engineers. In fact, there wasn't an engineer in the crowd. Finally said, "Well, let's take a look at the strength of this thing." So we all stood on one side, it didn't tip. We all went to one end, it didn't tip. We all, walked around using our weight to try to decide, because we knew tanks are very heavy. And finally, said, "Okay." It took one man to drive a tank, but there was a place for another man who's handling the radio and things like that, ordinarily called a gunner. And we used a third man in the turret of the tank to drive the tank, because the people inside can't see very much. So we got two crews of three men who could handle the tank, drive the thing around, and with great care, we aimed the first tank across the bridge. And it went. Nothing happened. We put the second tank, drove it across, and all the rest of the fellows went over with it, and we had an absolutely magnificent dinner. The next day in class, the old colonel that was running this school came in, and he said, "Gentlemen, I want to tell you something about yesterday's exercise." He said, "People have lived in communities ever since the dawn of time. They never had an election. They never had politics. They never had a religious hierarchy. What they had was themselves. Usually the elder led the village because he obviously had experience. If he'd been disabled or if he wasn't quite as bright as others. They could push him aside, but usually the elder led the community, and he would get things done. But if it came time to go on the hunt, and the village was hungry, and they really needed some animals, some food, a certain group would break off, and among that group, they knew the best hunter. They knew the best tracker. They knew the man. And have stop and have an election. There was no Boy Scout captain here. There was no election. So they just did the job. The women, the same way. Some women could build houses better than others, or some could make cloth better than others. And he said, that's the way communities run. He says, that's the way armies really run. And he said, the group will find its leader inevitably. He says, sometimes when an army is in a terrible battle, and the colonel has been killed, and the major has been killed, he said, probably a sergeant will get up and say, follow me. And he cited examples in history, because it's a very true statement. Well, he said, gentlemen, what we did yesterday was to prove to you that an absolutely nondescript, untrained group will follow that without any agreement, without any election, without any assignment. He said, we didn't assign the leader. We didn't ask you to elect the leader. We didn't say that so-and-so is an engineer and he has the experience. We left you in the dark and told you to come over there and have dinner with us. He said, don't ever forget that, because military organizations, as just ordinary civil organizations, follow those rules. The other rules are more or less applied to our society, but these are the basic rules. And he says, you need to know that in a war. And I have never been through a class that had quite the impact on me as that one did. And I guess not reluctantly, but it did surprise me. I was the officer that led the group across with the bridge, simply because I said to these people who were already beginning to go, let's put it here and then let's do this. And the group wanted some kind of instruction. I said, I would gladly have yielded to somebody else, but it wasn't necessary. The bridge got built. And I think as I look back at it, that much of the problem we have in society is that we don't trust ourselves. The people we elect are most likely not the people that can do the job anyway, or the people that we might even follow as, to quote, religious leaders, don't necessarily know all the things that are best for us. As Buckminster Fuller says, the two most powerfully disruptive forces in mankind are politics and religion. Now, he doesn't mean politics as I've described it in the village, and he doesn't mean religion among the basic facts of religion. He means these structured things that we call politics and call religion that really are a form of mind control. And in this century, I think that as much effort has been applied in certain areas of our leadership to gain mind control over the people of the world as I have over any other kind of control, I think that the very history of an organization we call the British Society of Psychic Research and its very strong American offshoot is evidence of the fact that today people are not asked to think. They're told what to think, whether it makes sense or not. I think this is the most fundamental fact of our life today.
Now, Monday, May 8th, and we're here again with Fletcher Prouty today to discuss aspects of the Kennedy assassination on November 22nd, 1963, and some of the ramifications of the types of power groups or power group base that seems to somehow have its hand in all this, from trying to examine the details of this massive area of information about a very seminal event for post-World War II directions in United States policies and agendas, at least in the political realm. I'd like to start with a pretty open-ended question, positing, knowing what you know now, if you were put in the position of being in charge of investigating Kennedy's assassination the day after he was murdered, when almost everyone was still alive, and you had subpoena power, etc., what witnesses would you call and what leads would you pursue?
Well, that certainly is a fundamental question. Of course, we all realize that murder in the United States, by law, by tradition, is the function of state governments. What should have been done immediately was to have the state of Texas begin to solve that murder without any delay. The body of President Kennedy should not have been moved from Texas. The autopsy should have been completed by the same people that were there when he was brought into the hospital. The police should have been the same police that were on duty when the president was moving through town. And the very next day, those policemen, all of them, should have been convened in a meeting so that everything they knew would be put down and recorded immediately, including the long conversations that had been had with Lee Harvey Oswald the night that he was picked up. Because I think most of us will recall that he was not picked up on the charge of having shot the president. He was picked up on a collateral charge of having something to do with the death of a policeman named Tippit. And it's rather interesting to note that some newspapers printed that Officer Tippit had been sent to arrest Oswald. And that was immediate printing. That was before the cover story came in. Later papers went along the cover story that Oswald, for some reason, got an argument with Tippit and shot him. Not anything to do with the original reports of the time. So, first of all, if any of us were on the spot and charged with solving that murder, we'd have done the same thing you do with any murder. We'd have policemen and detectives on the spot and immediately begin to ask the questions that would solve this murder, which was clearly the activity of several people, highly trained, and with a lot of other people in the area taking part in the business of this whole assassination. Well, if the work had been done that way, the possibility is that there would have been no mystery from the time of the autopsy right in the Parkland Hospital, because it was clear that the president had been hit in the back. That's a wound from the back. That he had been hit in the throat, a wound from the front. That he had been hit in the forehead, that's a wound from the side front. That the back of his head had been completely blown off, that's from a bullet going through his head and blowing off the back of his head. That there was a bullet that hit a man named Tague, who was a block and a half down the street. In other words, a low trajectory bullet, not one from the sixth floor going down to hit the pavement. This one went a block and a half and hit the curb through a fragment of the bullet or curb up, and that hit Mr. Tague in the face, and photographers took pictures of him with blood running down his face. That's another bullet. So there's four bullets right there. That disproves the entire Warren Commission report. But police would have handled that immediately. They would have gone to the places where those bullets originated from and begin to solve the crime the same as any other crime. There are reports of them locating a British 303 rifle, of a German Mauser rifle, and of this Italian Carcano rifle from the same period of time, within hours. Any police department would have resolved that immediately by finding the rifle that had been fired, by matching it to the bullets, and discarding the other bullet. If the normal police activity that takes place in any small town in the country had been put into motion within moments of that crime, it would have been solved before midnight. And if we remember, Oswald was not even charged with the death of Kennedy until after midnight. So even that aspect of it is illusory. And then they interviewed Oswald all during that night and claimed that they never took any notes at all. That's fabulous. They couldn't have done that in a police service unless the policemen were part of the... And you'd find that. Then you say to the police, you're part of the conspiracy, because why didn't you take notes? You see, could have stopped that thing immediately. Yeah. And with the body there to match it to all this evidence, there would have been none of these things about all the bullets from a single man up until now. As soon as you throw out, and it has taken the press in this world 25 years to throw out the idea that Oswald was the lone assassin, the House Committee study in the late 70s came up with the idea that they are convinced because they found more bullet, the more rifle firing sounds on the sound tapes than three, that they think there was a conspiracy. The newspapers haven't even picked it up. If you read a newspaper today, whether printed in San Francisco or Singapore, it says President Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. That is evidence of one of the most powerful cover-up situations ever created. That for 25 years they can force the media of the world to speak like parrots with respect to the death of Kennedy, that he was killed by a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. They will not print anything else. although 99% of the people of this world believe that the president was killed otherwise. It's a fascinating thing to think about how solid and how powerful this cover-up arrangement is. Then when you begin to add to that the fact that the plan to kill a president can only mean one thing, that the people who made that plan intended to take over control of the United States of America, then you begin to see that they have the power to kill the president and to create the cover-up and, of course, to take over the presidency for the objectives that they had. Those things begin to clarify who did it, how they did it, why they did it. That's what you do with any crime. So if I had been in charge of the investigation of the president's death in Dallas for the next 24 hours afterwards, I think within 6 or 8 hours we'd have solved the crime. There would have been none of this lone assassin business. Now, the important thing about having people realize that there was not a lone assassin is the next step, that if there was a group and if they conspired to kill the president, then they had an objective. A lone assassin doesn't have to have an objective. He can be a nut. Somebody just fired the gun and he's a nut. And that's what they try to make us believe. But the minute you say there were people who planned to kill the president, whether it was Castro and his people, whether it was Khrushchev and his people, whether it was the mafia and their people, or some other hate group, they had an objective. And at least we are maturing in our thinking about Kennedy's death. By now we can say the mafia did it, or Castro did, at least we are pointing the finger to groups that have an objective. And I think within the next 3 or 4 years, they will finally begin to come around to what this objective was. And we may become mature enough in this country by 30 years after Kennedy's death to begin to lay down exactly what happened at the time he was killed, that an extremely powerful group within the United States government set up the objective of killing Kennedy in order to control the progress of the government in the direction they wanted for the next 8, 10, 12 years. There's no question about it looking back.
And in that current scenario, there's various groups that have at times been, there's been some stories put out positing Castro wanted to kill him or the mob, which all to me seem derelict in the ability, which was not Castro or Khrushchev or the mob's capabilities, of engineering things like getting the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to head up a commission to cover it up, or the Dallas Police Department or whoever else, the authorities either locally or federally, who had some key roles here or there in at least the post-assassination alteration of stories to conform to a lone nut. That's,
well, you see, that's what I'm saying. When we finally mature ourselves enough to realize that the president was not killed by a lone assassin who had no real motive, he just did it. The minute we move ourselves into saying that some organization did it, whether it's Castro, Khrushchev, mafia, whatever, immediately we are saying there was a motive for doing this. Now, the motive then is one of a group that, and their objective, of course, was the control of the government of the United States. Now, as soon as we think that a group did this, the next thing is to think of the environment in which it happened. A lot of things were happening in the 90 days before the president was killed. He had made a speech at the UN saying that he was not going to have NASA arrange the shot to the moon by itself, but he was going to merge our space agency in with the Russian space agency in a cooperative attempt to go to the moon. He thought that would be internationally palatable. It would help ease the pressures of the Cold War and would really make progress for the world as well as putting a man on the moon. Well, now, of course, that upset the tens of thousands of people who work for NASA and their supporters throughout the industry and a lot of other people who were just believe in anti-communism in the Cold War anyway. But Kennedy had done that within 90 days before his death. Another thing that a lot of other people have not noticed, because it's a little more intricate, is that at the time Kennedy became president, one of the biggest aircraft procurement projects ever designed was on the boards. The Eisenhower administration had not settled it, and they handed it over to the Kennedy administration, assuming, of course, that they thought Nixon was going to be elected and he would solve the problem. It was called the TFX fighter program. With that much money, upwards of $6 to $7 billion, I believe, which in those days was an enormous amount of money, there was an awful lot of pressure on a selection of this TFX fighter. And it was it finally came down to a consortium with the General Dynamics Company of California versus the proposals from the Boeing Company. And in this work, the Kennedy administration changed drastically the method of weapons procurement that had existed since World War II. And one of the active parts in this was the role of Arthur Goldberg, the Secretary of Labor, who, a very politically astute gentleman, saw that the Kennedy election over Nixon was a very, very narrow margin. So that what Goldberg proposed was that if the companies bidding for the aircraft own properties and factories in areas where Kennedy needed the vote, then the one with the most factories in the most areas should be given the contract, simply so that that money would flow in areas that would be politically expedient to Kennedy's re-election in 1963. Well, this was, a lot of people didn't see that working, but within the Pentagon, for example, they set up a series of offices, posted on the walls county divided maps of the whole United States, county by county, state by state, and they would draw the colored markers on there. Every General Dynamics proposal, they'd set the colors up for the counties the General Dynamics covered, and the Boeing proposal likewise, so that by the time they got to make the decision on the aircraft, they decided to purchase the General Dynamics plane versus, you might say, the more popular, at least within the military industry complex, Boeing suggestion. And the final McNamara decision to give that contract to General Dynamics staggered the industry. And it's a very powerful industry to have opposition. In addition to that, Mr. McNamara's Deputy Secretary of Defense, Roswell Gilpatrick, was traveling around the country speaking at bankers' conventions and other important meetings, saying that from now on the Kennedy administration was going to see that procurement money was more wisely used and that the old power groups of the Eisenhower days were ended. And although that was a rather quiet thing with respect to news, it was a most important area of opposition to the Kennedy administration. It was a very important area. So there's a second one added up. In the Vietnam War, which was growing, and you know, in 1962, 1963, the Vietnam War was not a big issue. It was a small thing. The trouble in Laos was more important. The trouble in the Congo was more important. It wasn't the whole thing. We did more in anti-Castro work, you might say, than we did in Vietnam. So that it's by looking back at it that we think the Vietnam War in 63 was a major issue. So by the summer of 63, Kennedy had properly analyzed that if the people of South Vietnam wanted to set up their own country and run their own country, they were going to have to fight for their own country, the same as our people did in the Revolutionary War against the British. It was the Americans that fought the British and did it themselves. And he thought that Vietnamization was the way to do it. We would provide the support and we would help them. With that on his mind, he set up the procedures to produce what became NSAM 263, where he announced to the public that with before the end of the year, he would bring 1,000 troops home for Christmas. And by the end of 1965, he would bring the bulk of American personnel home, and personnel being a comprehensive term, not just military, but all the personnel in Vietnam. It just happens that I worked on that paper with General Krulak and his staff, and I have no question about the significance of the words in that paper, because we were instructed by the White House to see that this was clear, that 1,000 men will be home by the end of 63, and the bulk of American personnel by the end of 65. Kennedy was removing us from Vietnam. And that hit like a bolt of lightning. So there were those pressures. There were pressures in the education system, and there was sufficient pressure to see that certain groups would like to remove Kennedy, because by the end of 63, it was becoming clear that he would win the next election and have another 4 years in office, that Bobby was right behind him, that Teddy was right behind Bobby, and on. It was a Kennedy regime being set up. I think that pressure is what caused his death, because it is that kind of pressure that could very easily weld itself together into an assassination program, where the assassination was be laid on in a professional manner, as they are done in coup d'etats around the world, where the hitmen are professionals, they are covered by the local police and removed from the scene, and they're gone, and then nobody knows who did it, and they never find out about it. That's the way Kennedy was killed, and those are the reasons for which he was killed.
In looking back at the actual execution of the murder, the planning and execution, what role, if any, do you feel the following government agencies or individuals within those agencies played? I want to just run down a list here. Start with the FBI.
Well, I'll just say first that no agency played a role as an agency. What happens in such things as this? In fact, we had a term for it. We called it the Gold Key Club. A certain small group coalesces, and they are given an order to do something, and it's not by agency. As a comparison, there was a program that had been constituted, I think, in 62, called Mongoose. And the objective of Mongoose was to remove Castro from office in Cuba. Well, the people that were assigned to Mongoose under the direction of General Lansdale were from various agencies working together, and some who were not from any agencies. They were hired employees from other specialties and other businesses that are competent in this business of establishing coup d'etats and things like that. So it's not correct to say that the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Defense, State Department had a role in this. It could very well be, and I'm quite sure it was, that people from those agencies might have been called upon for certain specialties, mm-hmm. but that isn't how these jobs are done.
So there wouldn't be much point in going through, as far as being able to have anyone that you felt somehow, oh yeah, well, that person must have had this to do with it or that to do with it. Not
that specifically. Those things are done. I worked on assassinations in other countries, or the removal of office from people from other countries, and it was not done agency by agency. It was done on the basis of a very cleverly arranged group arrangement, which would get the job done.
Okay.
By people who are very proficient in that type of business.
I would like to look at a few instances, though, of just examining what evidence did go down, particularly in terms of something like the Secret Service. Now, you served in some function in Eisenhower's term as something to do with helping with security for the president with the Secret Service.
Okay, that's an interesting point. The Secret Service is well-trained, and it has manuals that direct how they operate for what is called protection of the president. It's a small organization, and what they do in general practice is augment the Secret Service, when necessary, with specially trained units from the U.S. military. And the thing that we notice in the assassination of President Kennedy was that certain of these Secret Service units and military units that should have been along the streets in Dallas, that should have closed windows in Dallas, that should have welded manhole covers in the streets, and should have done all of the things, should have designed a route through the city that was safe. For instance, they have a rule that says if your automobile with the president cannot travel 44 miles an hour, you have to go on another route. I argued with them one day, just kind of jokingly, why 44? Why not 45? Why not 4? And they said, we have learned that at 44 miles an hour, a gunman has a very great difficulty following the target and hitting the target. So that's the level. See, what it meant was, if you had to go through the city at 30 miles an hour or at 15 miles an hour, then you take additional precautions. Well, they didn't even take the precautions that are required at 44 miles an hour, even though the president was moving at about 6 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And how this happened was that in the days before they went to Dallas, and you know they had been touring in Texas, calls were made to certain military units and to certain Secret Service units saying, you won't be needed in Dallas. Maybe they were using San Antonio. Maybe they were using Houston. And to the military unit, they said, we don't need you in Dallas. Well, the assumption of that commander is that somebody else's military unit is, you know, there's a lot of these units, and he would be used. They never dreamed that it meant the city would have nobody. And as you know from the record, there was no Secret Service and no military men of this with this training in the Dealey Plaza area. Mm-hmm. The evidence of it is the photographs. One of the first things the Secret Service would do in a place like the Dealey Plaza area, where high buildings look down over the road, is they would close all the windows and seal them. Put a seal on it that says to anyone working in the building, do not open the window. Then they say, yes, but how are you going to control maybe hundreds of people? It's not hard. You put a man on the roof with a radio. You put another man down in the middle of the plaza on the grass looking up, and he's got a radio. If he sees a window open, he broadcasts immediately, third floor, fourth window over. And one of the team on the roof runs down there, sees why the window, some secretary opened a window to see the president go by, and you say, close that window, and it's closed. If it isn't, you stop the president's parade. You got a radio, you can do it. You see, it's not a big job. In fact, it's done every day. I went to Mexico City with the people that were sent to protect the President Eisenhower in Mexico City, and you'd think, my word, we can't get the president through here safely. But we do. There's no problem with it, if you do the job.
Yeah.
What happened to the Secret Service was not that the Secret Service didn't do their job. They weren't asked to do the job. They were told, your unit isn't needed, you can go home. And then they didn't tell anybody to do it. Very, very clever planning, because it would make it seem as though the Secret Service didn't do their job. It wasn't their fault, see? Or that the Army, I have talked to the Army commander involved, and he didn't know that there wasn't going to be the other Army unit there. He thought, if his unit isn't needed, the other one will be there, see? And it's very hard for those people to, it's like if you go out in the woods with a hunting dog, and all of a sudden the dog sees a pheasant and he starts running, you say no. Well, the dog's trained to go for the, he wants to go for the pheasant. See, you have a hard job stopping him. This is his job. Well, this happened in Dallas in all of these things. Then added to this, there were false Secret Service there. Many, many witnesses who were on the ground in Dallas said something like, I was taking pictures, and a man who showed me the credentials of Secret Service took my camera and removed the film. And he identified himself as Secret Service. Or others said that they met people there who identified themselves as police. In fact, there were pictures of policemen at the Dealey Plaza area, ostensibly Dallas policemen, but they're in stage uniforms. They're not in police uniforms. Their insignia don't match Dallas police. The shoes are different from Dallas police. They're carrying shotguns, something Dallas police don't carry, and so on. Who put those teams together? And who put them in Dallas at this time? What arrangements were made ahead of the president's murder that had all those people there before the president was even shot? You see, that's how you answer the problem of who killed the president, how he was killed, and why he was killed. What pressure groups were built up that would enable a team of hundreds of people to work on this? And I haven't even mentioned how other trained people, for instance, operated at the autopsy room, so that when the doctors, trying to save the life of the president, wrote down that they saw the whole back of the president's head gone from the gunshot wound, that they operated on a cut in his throat that was an entry wound. Then by the time they had the autopsy in the Bethesda Naval Hospital, 8 or 10 hours later, they reported wounds of entry in different places. They had completely shifted the autopsy around. Who arranged all that? Who arranged that entire cover story?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Zapruda, who took the film of this thing, just happened to be there with a movie camera. He happened to be taking pictures of the president's car as it went by. Somebody located him that night, and the life magazine people paid him, I don't know, $50,000, some big amount of money for his film. Then when the Life magazine published extracts from his film, they reversed certain of the film slides to make it appear that the president's head went forward when it really went backward and so on. Who set up that cover story? You see, the whole thing is shot through with cover stories. That shows an enormous power center behind the president. Certainly not Lee Harvey Oswald or Castro or the Mafia or some other nebulous group. This was an inside, powerful group that scheduled all the events of this thing so that they would come together with not only the murder of the president, but the takeover of the U.S. government.
In some of the writings you've done, which are being compiled currently into a book called The Saigon Solution, about the CIA involvement in Indochina and, in effect, climaxing with the assassination of Kennedy, you write about aspects of this security being so lax in Dealey Plaza and no one being on the buildings and none of the windows being closed and all of the airtight procedures that they had developed as an agency, the Secret Service, since they had been formed in the 1903 or whatever after McKinley's assassination, and none of those things being followed that day, which then recently I was reading Jim Garrison's new book On the Trail of the Assassins, where he lays out evidence of the parade route map on the front page of the Dallas Morning News that morning, November 22nd, showing the parade going straight down Main Street, never indicating any turn onto Houston or then another turn onto Elm. And in that type of context, if the top-level Secret Service people were not even aware of this last-minute change, because as of that morning, they were still saying, no, the parade route is going straight down Main Street if you want to go along the route and have a good chance of seeing the president. What is your sense of how the Secret Service or who was somehow involved in this monumental setting up of the ambush site by rerouting the last-minute change in the parade route to accommodate this absolutely essential place to get the car to go slow enough to get a shot in?
That's a very important detail that Jim Garrison has pointed out, because the Secret Service, along with its military assistance, studies the route that the president will travel over in any city, not just Dallas, any city, for at least 90 days ahead of time. They study all the idiosyncrasies of that bit of the city, you know, where people could be hidden on a roof, what windows, what angle of fire they'd have from certain windows, what speed the car would be traveling at certain corners. And of course, they try to reduce corners. They try to go perfectly straight. And that's what the map in the paper showed, a straight route right through the city. Well, it is not Secret Service policy to change a route at the last minute. They've done too much work. If something comes up that causes them to want to change a route at the last minute, they're more apt to change the president's trip entirely, but not even have him stop there. Okay. They did that just before the trip to Dallas. It was either a trip to Chicago or a trip to Miami where they had some problem, and the public was told that President Kennedy was suffering from a severe cold and could not make the trip. Well, the Secret Service isn't going to put him in a position where he's doing something counter to their own best regulations. And they have very thorough regulations. They can keep the president alive. So the fact that the parade route was changed, and changed even after, apparently, after the Dallas News had been told what the route was, and after they printed a major map, what was it, about 5/6 of the front page. It was an enormous map on the front page of the paper. And then the route was changed in spite of that, is simply underscoring our evidence that elements within the structure of the government at a very high level were able to get such things as that route change, despite the fact they had told, for instance, the Dallas News very shortly before the parade that he was going to be on a certain route.
Right.
Now, the important thing there is that if the Dallas News knew that, the Dallas Police knew that, the Dallas Sheriff's Office knew that, the Secret Service knew that, the military people working on the deal knew that, everybody else knew that the route was one. And then all of a sudden, when he made this drastic change around the triangle there and the car slowed to 4 or 5 miles an hour, it was a shock to all of these people there. And yet, what is really amazing is you don't hear any of these people talking about that. And maybe hundreds of them were on duty that day and found that their jobs were totally ignored as the car went off on its own somewhere else. And yet, there's been no word from them. They've been covered up totally. You see, it works both ways. The place was left vacant of its normal guard, of its normal observation and all that sort of thing. And then the men that were there and saw this happen have been kept from speaking about that ever since. I don't know the witness of any man from the Secret Service or any other place that tries to explain why that change was made. They just leave it hanging in the air like that as though, well, it's something we can't account for. It's part of the crime, just like everything else. And Garrison is right to point that out.
Which, there's other discrepancies as well in terms of seeing that somehow there must have been a lot of people who did sense a different parade route because, of course, there was a great throng of people right at the corner of Houston and Elm. Zapruder was up on
well,
the pergola.
Well, but the streets were very close. It was a small triangle. And the fact, as you notice in some of the pictures taken, people who had been on Main Street were walking across the grass over to the other street. Really, it was not that kind of a problem from the viewer's point of view. What it was is it put the president at a very slow speed, making corners that he should not have been making, and right under the guns, and I say guns on purpose, that had been placed there to kill him. And it was absolute ambush, if ever I saw one, a real Wild West ambush.
There was, you showed me the AP photograph you had the other day of some of the tramps that were picked up, and there were no recorded arrests besides that of Lee Harvey Oswald that day, when in fact, at least in this case, there was four or five photographs of three different people being led from the railroad yards through Dealey Plaza over to the police station, and yet no record ever of anyone else being arrested. But these people appeared to be being taken in, although, as you said, some of the officers in those photographs are wearing stage uniforms, the emblems don't match, etc. In one photograph particularly, there's a person who is walking away from the camera. It's the only person in the photograph you can't see the face of. And one of the tramps in the front that he's just passed sort of has a smirk on his face. Could you comment about your interpretation of who that is in that photograph?
Well, the photographic evidence as a total at that time is absolutely amazing. I believe it has been said that there's something between, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 pictures taken. That includes single slides from movie cameras and the rest. But what various researchers have done is take all these photographs and place them in a time frame so that you can see where people standing in one place and there's the same person over here and other ones, and begin to identify some of these people. So we've worked very hard on looking carefully at who is in these pictures. Well, there are several of them that are really outstanding. And one of the most amazing is this group of these three men who the news story said had been removed from a boxcar in a rail yard right in back of Dealey Plaza and were being led from that boxcar by police to the sheriff's office. And that's the end of it. The trail ends. They weren't booked. There's no record of them at all. Well, let's look at the pictures. The pictures do show three men that somebody have called tramps. Well, they're dressed in brand new clothes. They got new shoes on. They have new clothes on. They are not tramps. The police that are leading them, one in front and one in back, are in what we call stage costume police uniform, because they are not Dallas police costume, the police uniforms. Their insignia do not match. One of them has very clearly a hearing device in his ear. Their shotguns are not police shotguns. Police don't carry shotguns. And furthermore, the Dallas police don't lead prisoners into the sheriff's office. The police and the sheriff's office work together, but their jobs are entirely different. And in a sense, taking prisoners to the sheriff's office is the last place the police would take any prisoners. So all that part of it is very questionable. So when researchers had arrived at that point, one of them came to me one day and said, look, of all the pictures we've studied, this little episode of these men being marched right across the in front of the school book depository building where Oswald was supposed to have been, and across the street by Dealey Plaza where the president's car had just gone, into the sheriff's office. There's something wrong about these pictures. So we looked at them very carefully. And in the very first picture, in addition to the two policemen and the three tramps, as they're called, is another man. And he's walking in the other direction. But the thing about it is, so that his back is more or less to the, or his side and his back is more or less to the photographer rather than face forward. There's something about it is, how is it possible that anyone at Dealey Plaza that day, and here these men are probably being marched across there 5 minutes after the president was killed. Everybody was running around. People were excited. Sirens were blowing. And here's this man in a business suit just as casually walking along. He doesn't even turn. He's not looking at anybody, just walking past. And he happens to be standing by these men as they're being marched. The least he would be doing is looking at these prisoners or looking at the policemen. You know, anybody would, especially at that time. This man's looking at nobody. So we studied him a little while. And I looked at it, and this was, I must say, what would I say, 66, 67, somewhere back there. And I recognized immediately that that man is General Lansdale. Now, Lansdale is a very interesting figure in the Kennedy era. And I know Lansdale. I worked with him off and on from about 1952 to 1963. So he retired. Now, this is interesting. He retired from the Air Force on October 31st, 1963. Well, of course, the picture could have been 100 other people, and I could be wrong. But I know him very well. Then I looked at the tramps themselves. And there's this strange little eye catch between this man and the first tramp coming by. In other words, the first tramp, instead of being seriously concerned about the fact that he may be charged with the murder of the president, is smiling. And the second tramp has a sort of a quizzical little look, and you can tell that he has looked at this man walking by. And he has the same kind of approach, you know, as though he's just been reassured, everything's all right. The third man happens to be in back from the camera's point of view, and you don't see him at all. But that little bit of expression is saying an awful lot at that moment. The police themselves have expressions that indicate more that, as if they were saying to somebody, say, boss, am I doing all right? You know, that kind of thing. In other words, was Lansdale walking down right in front of the school book depository building to sort of reassure some people here, maybe his employees or somebody that's working for him? What's the significance of that? Well, of course, that happened to be my own interpretation. The men who had brought the pictures to me hadn't the slightest idea who it was. And I decided at that moment that what was needed next was a lot of research. So I got some very clear copies of those professional pictures. These pictures were taken by a professional news cameraman. I got a clear picture. And I started mailing the picture to acquaintances of mine and acquaintances of Lansdale who knew him without any of my thoughts. I simply would send the picture and say, can you tell me what this looks like to you? This was taken shortly after the death of the president, and I wonder if this picture calls anything to mind to you. You'd be amazed to find that from senior people in the government, such as Lansdale was or such as I was at the time, I got immediate confirmation. That said, Lansdale. Yeah. Well, now, I don't know why he was in Dallas. I can't go into that. But it's astounding that this man, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations after General Graves Erskine retired, who was the man who had more or less almost single-handedly set up Diem as president of South Vietnam, who again almost single-handedly had set up President Magsaysay as the president of the Philippines, who was considered probably the most significant person in the U.S. military, U.S. government, on the subject of counterinsurgency, civic action, special forces, Green Beret troops. He had written the books that the Green Berets used in their courses down at Fort Bragg. What could have been his role at that time? I had a very personal interest in that because only a month or two before that, Lansdale had met me in the halls of the Pentagon and said that he had arranged for me to go as a military escort officer with a VIP party to the South Pole. Of course, I didn't mind going as a paid by vacation to the South Pole, but it had nothing to do with my work, the work I'd been doing for years in the Pentagon. There were no special reason why I should go. The work at the South Pole had nothing to do with special operations or covert activities. It was a perfectly above board job. And it happened that I left for the South Pole on about November 10th or something like that, and that I was in New Zealand on the way back from the South Pole when I heard about President Kennedy being killed. Why Lansdale asked me to go to the South Pole, I have no idea. Or was there some connection between this role that he may have been playing in Dallas and the fact that he would just as soon I be out of town? And I reflected on that, especially when I began to realize that almost all of Kennedy's cabinet was out of town, that some 45 officials with the cabinet were also out of town in Honolulu and on their way to Tokyo. They were actually on their way to Tokyo when the president was killed. And over the years, I have made a study of how many people central to the inner workings of the secret government of this country had been moved out of Washington at that time. It's a very, very interesting subject. I wish I could answer it. I don't know how to answer it. I'm sure the picture is Lansdale. Others are sure it's Lansdale. And I have to leave it there.
This is KPFK Los Angeles. We're listening to Colonel Fletcher Prouty in conversation with David Ratcliffe, speaking on JFK, the assassination of JFK, and the High Cabal. And we continue with Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
This experience you had in New Zealand was very interesting to me in terms of the influence and scope of the kinds of stories that were flooding out of, I guess it was British AP as well as others, moments or at least hours immediately after the assassination. Why don't you talk more about how that, in retrospect, you got the newspaper at the time and looking back on it, how it didn't seem to make sense?
This is an interesting aspect of the president's murder, and I'd like to know more about what was printed in overseas papers. But I was in New Zealand, specifically Christchurch, New Zealand, at the time the president was killed. And I was with a U.S. congressman. We were having breakfast. And of course, it's shocking news, but limited over the radio. They only announced that he had been killed, and he'd been killed in Dallas. And that's all we knew for several hours. Then the Christchurch newspaper, and of course this was Saturday morning in Christchurch, New Zealand, the newspaper came out, I would estimate, some 3 hours, maybe 4 hours after the president's death. It was an extra. They were hawking it down the streets, and of course I ran out and grabbed the first copy I could get, which I still have. I showed it to you the other day. Well, it's a very interesting thing, because news that's printed immediately like that is more apt to come right from the record than to have been massaged a little bit the way the weekly magazines had it, or even some of our own newspapers where they had access to things, their own telephones and everything. And of course, I understand completely that world news today is in real time. There's no shortage of information. But the problem of researching and digging things out of files takes a certain amount of time. So this first paper on the street is really a most important statement of the way things were handled with respect to news immediately after or even before the president was killed. So we read the paper. There's a big picture of Kennedy in the paper, obviously, and a story about Kennedy and his 1,000 days in Washington and the significance of those things. The other half of the paper is devoted to what reporters right on the scene had sent out from there. And one report, either attributed to a reporter from Reuters or British AP, said that he heard automatic rifle fire. Now, these experienced reporters who have credentials to travel in presidential processions like that are highly qualified men. Many have been war reporters, and many have been in all kinds of events where they certainly know the difference between a single shot rifle going bing, bing, bing over 6 seconds, or automatic weapons fire, where they're going brrr like that and they know something happened. So that those few lines where the paper printed that the president was killed by a burst of automatic fire say quite a bit, when later the Warren Commission tries to tell us that a lone gunman fired 3 separate shots over 6.8 seconds. That's the first thing we noticed. Then we read a little further down the column, and they began to talk about Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, remember at that time, Lee Harvey Oswald is a nondescript American ex-Marine, 23, 24 years old. And, of course, police have files on people, and the newspapers have files. And with a little bit of research, they can put these things together, and you can expect you'd get some information. But what they print about Oswald is very elaborate, that he had gone to Russia, he'd worked in Russia, he had defected to Russia, married a Russian wife, had come back and went to work in Dallas, had worked with a Fair Play for Cuba committee in New Orleans. And it's almost like a book written 5 years later. There's enough information about Oswald to fill pages. Furthermore, there's a picture of Oswald well-dressed in a business suit, whereas when he was picked up on the streets of Dallas after the president's death, he had on some
a t-shirt
or something, very, you know, just dressed sort average with a polo shirt or something like on, but not a business suit with a necktie and all that. So of course I had no reason not to believe what I read in the paper. These things I've studied since then, but even so, you wonder, now where did the paper get that information so immediately and such complete information? But the headline was even more important. It said, "This is the man alleged to have shot the president." Well, now, the police in Dallas had picked up Oswald in a theater on the grounds that he may have been the killer of a Dallas policeman named Tippett. Not because of the president. And it was either midnight or 1 o'clock the next morning before the Dallas police had finally issued the
formal charge.
The charges against Oswald, long after the paper had been printed.
Right.
Well, who wrote the scenario? Who wrote that script? Who had packaged all that information and distributed it, I assume, all over the world? If it got to Christchurch, New Zealand, it must have been everywhere else. Who had handled all that type of information prior to the president's death?
Right.
See? So that even just this business of the news releases begins to tell you that a big organization, big enough to have planted this information ahead of the president's death, was involved in the murder of the president. We've talked about the Honolulu conference and that the cabinet members were there. The speeches some of those cabinet members were supposed to have made in Japan were actually printed in the American newspapers on the day they were supposed to have made the speeches, even though they never went to Japan. Now, that's not always too surprising because speeches are mailed out ahead of time. But it is surprising to think that with the intervening death of the president, that something wasn't done immediately to recall that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So much news was already written ahead of time to say that Oswald killed the president and that he did it with these 3 shots. And yet things like the statement of automatic weapon fire begin to nullify some of that, because that's the clash between the reporter on the spot or the man that just got this big release coming over the wires that said Oswald was the killer of the president. I suppose if somebody got newspapers from 100 different cities around the world, you'd be able even more to corroborate this, because the information fed to them was all prior work.
Right.
Somebody had decided Oswald was going to be the patsy. And that's what the newspapers say. And there's his picture right in the Christchurch, New Zealand paper, right along the same issue with the picture of President Kennedy.
And as it's so telling to me is that we looked at it on a couple of days ago when we were looking at this paper, and we decided that you said you got that paper by midday on Saturday your time, which would have been about 3 or 4 hours after about 4:30 in the afternoon or so on Friday, November 22nd, Central Daylight Time, which was at least 8 hours before Oswald was charged officially with the murder of the president.
You see, to put the times in prospect, he was killed in Dallas at about 12:30 in the afternoon. That corresponded to 7:30 in the morning in Christchurch, New Zealand. I got the paper before noon, which is, we'll say, 7:30 to noon, four hours. Okay? Now, that would mean in Dallas about 4:30 in the afternoon. Well, Oswald hadn't even been charged by the police with the murder, with the shooting at the president, by 4:30 in the afternoon. How did the papers get the information to say that? You see, and then the rest of the things that are in the paper also are equally unfounded, that the paper was saying what the police were going to say some 8 hours later.
Yeah.
It had to have been a set-up job to put that information in the papers. And such a lot. I'm only quoting a few things. There were the articles that I'm talking about were on the front page. They also had follow-on in the back pages of the paper. It was just filled with stuff about Oswald that most people didn't know for days and days in the rest of the country.
And the significance that those stories were coming from British AP, whereas the story about the bursts of automatic gunfire were from a Dallas
directly from Dallas, yes.
So
yes.
There's
a intervening procedure there. But again, we understand that news can travel anywhere in the world in real time. That's not the problem. It's the content. How the content could have been put together immediately. If anybody wants to study this in a rather interesting parallel, try to read the newspapers immediately after the allegation that President Reagan was shot by Hinckley right on the streets of Washington, and you'll see that it took hours and hours for information to fall out of the papers with regard to Hinckley and all that sort of thing, whereas the information that came out about Oswald was out right away in minutes. It just doesn't make sense.
In an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And then he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. But I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against it not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I am disappointed with America. There can be no great disappointment where there is no great love.
Those who say to me, stick to civil rights, I have another answer. That is that I've fought too long and too hard now against segregated public accommodation to end up segregating my moral concern. I'm not going to do that. The others can do what they want to do. That's their business. Other civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration. That's their business. But I'm afraid that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized, and we still do, and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA, secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese and Korean. We had the Korean War and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level, or the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this Third World War that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954, when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody, gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs. They don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
What you saw in the Iran-Contra hearings was the exposure of the beginnings of a national security state which believes it has the right to override the Constitution of the United States in the name of security.
I think that there was a substantial shadow government trying to run foreign affairs for the United States.
In any other country, it would have been called a coup. And they seem to have gotten away with it.
Modern-day pirates, these guys, they have escaped essentially the control of national governments, but they're available for use by national governments. Sometimes they move under color of, and defend themselves as advancing U.S. national interests in this. But I think that's very secondary with these guys. They're out to make a buck.
I did do it. I am not, as I said in my statement, at all ashamed of any of the things that I did. I was given a mission, and I tried to carry it out.
The Iran-Contra hearings, convened in May 1987 by a special joint committee of the United States Congress to investigate the sale of U.S. weapons to Iran and the illegal diversion of money to the Contras. Often, the official explanation seemed inadequate and contradictory.
Our government has a firm policy not to capitulate to terrorist demands, that no concessions policy remains in force, in spite of the wildly speculative and false stories about arms for hostages and alleged ransom payments. We did not, repeat, did not trade weapons or anything else for hostages, nor will we.
Despite Reagan's denials, investigations soon revealed that arms had been traded for hostages held in the Mideast.
A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
Only days later, it was further revealed that the arms to Iran had been severely marked up. Some of the profits had been illegally diverted to support the Contras, a guerrilla force organized by the CIA fighting the Nicaraguan government. The Reagan administration had a major scandal on its hands. The use of U.S. government money for supporting the overthrow of the Nicaraguan government was specifically prohibited when Congress enacted the Boland Amendment in 1984. Even though it remained in effect until 1986, millions of dollars in profits from Iranian arms sales were secretly diverted to the Contras during this period through contacts with middlemen such as Moniker Gobanifar. Did these hearings uncover the full story behind the Contragate scandal? Or was it merely an attempt to keep the real truth hidden from public view? Peter Dale Scott, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has conducted extensive research on covert action and CIA activities. The results are detailed in his book, The Iran-Contra Connection.
I think the real issue was that both the administration and the majority of the people in the committees were frightened that the real scandals, the drug scandals, for example, would really threaten any future conduct of covert operations on the scale that they had been handled in the past. And so they were trying very deliberately to limit the damage. This was damage control.
And so they were pulling their punches on all the major questions and issues of what really happened in this thing, what the CIA's role was. Anytime they got into anything that was really sensitive about exactly that, exactly what the CIA's role was and exactly what laws were broken and when, they went into secret session.
There was a lot of talk during the hearings about covert operations, national security, the necessity of secrecy in conducting foreign policy. But some experts claim that covert action does not work in the interest of the U.S. national security, nor does it create a more stable world.
To think of the democratic governments that have been overthrown in the last 30 years by military coups is almost like giving a capsule history of CIA covert operations in the last 30 years. I mean, There was the overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. There was the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. There was the overthrow of the Brazilian government in 1964. There was the overthrow of the Ghana government in 1966. A lot of the governments I've just mentioned got into trouble with the international oil companies because they tried to assert their national prerogatives over their own resources. Time after time, the CIA has come in on behalf of those multinational companies.
You start a huge covert war that you intend is going to be secret. It's not secret from the Russians. Certainly not secret from the Laotians who are getting shot at, or the Angolans or the Nicaraguans or whoever it is. It's covert from the American taxpayer and voter. And a lot of people make a lot of money off of it. And it attracts criminals. And it has every single time.
Who are the names, the faces, behind these covert activities? Some, like Oliver North, General Secord, Albert Hakim, are practically household names. But whether there is actually an organized secret team or simply a loose association of individuals, it is clear that there are a number of people who have been working actively behind the scenes in these covert operations. Some of the names are Theodore Shackley, who was Assistant Deputy Director of Operations for the Central Intelligence Agency as of 1976, under George Bush, who was CIA director at the time. Thomas Kleins, who worked as a case officer under Shackley in Miami and in Laos. General John Singlaub, who worked with Shackley and Kleins in Vietnam and was in charge of the CIA's special operations over the border into Laos. General Richard Secord, who supervised the air operations into Laos and was later assigned to the Pentagon, where he was put in charge of arms sales to Iran. Albert Hakim, who was a salesman for U.S. weapons companies and a middleman in the Iran-Contra affair.
These are the men who have been stirring the pot around the world to instigate these wars on the side of the right wing. And that's the group that we're dealing with right here. We're making war around the world for their own personal profit.
Cuban revolutionary troops such as these have invaded Castro's leftist island fortress, reportedly rallied by a mysterious coded radio message. Alert! Alert! From the sea.
It was after the failed invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in 1961 that Theodore Shackley, as CIA station chief in Miami, and his assistant Thomas Kleins, began working with Rafael Quintero and other right-wing Cubans to overthrow the Castro government. In 1965, Shackley and Kleins were transferred to Laos, where Shackley became CIA station chief, Kleins his assistant once again. It was here in Southeast Asia that they teamed up with General Secord and Singlaub.
And they there began running the secret war in Laos and Cambodia and Thailand. Everybody in the United States basically thought the war was going on in Vietnam. In fact, it was a major dirty war, covert war. It was fought primarily through assassinations of people that were suspected sympathizers of the Path at Lao or other people who were not terribly sympathetic to the Western powers.
When Theodore Shackley was promoted to director of CIA Western Hemisphere Operations, he supervised the plans to overthrow the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende. Allende, a socialist, had promised to nationalize the copper mines and other industries and posed a threat to U.S. business interests in Chile. After a bloody coup, Allende was replaced by a right-wing military dictator, Augusto Pinochet, whose security forces brutally murdered and tortured thousands of political dissidents. as private businessmen and government operatives, Shackley, Clines, and Secord, along with Wilson and middleman Albert Hakim, turned their attention to the Mideast. They supplied arms to Mideast governments while skimming off huge profits into hidden bank accounts around the world. They secretly supplied weapons and military intelligence to Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza and helped the Shah of Iran eliminate his enemies.
There is an early bond between Iran and Nicaragua. The bond is this secret team of men. So throughout that period from October of 1977 to December of 1978, this secret team has two major operations, one to support the Shah, the other to support the right-wing dictator Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua. This was their world at that time. The Shah collapses in December of 78, and Anastasio Somoza collapses in July of 1979.
After the overthrow of Somoza, many of his former National Guardsmen fled to Honduras, where they were organized and trained by the CIA as a counter-revolutionary force to fight against the new government in Nicaragua.
They began to create the Contras, to try to do the identical thing that was done by the supporters of Batista against the Cuban revolutionary government back in 1959. Not an indigenous force inside Nicaragua that had any support from any of the population in Nicaragua. It was a total artifice that was created by these men.
One of the original contra-political leaders was Edgar Chamorro. He joined the Contras in 1981.
I became involved with the Contras because the CIA, using people from the White House, they invited me to be one of the Contra leaders. I was told that this was just a war for a year, that the United States wanted to put this pressure on Nicaragua. But then after a year or so, I found out that this was not the case. We were being used to deceive the American people. We were used to lie to Congress. The tactics used by the Contras were tactics of terrorizing civilians, making situations where civilians were getting killed.
In Nicaragua, under President Reagan, they are in fact giving the Contras written instructions in violence and destabilization. The target is the people. The social and economic infrastructure is what you're hitting at. It's not a bloodbath. It's like you go into a village and you kill a few people to make your point. The purpose is to disseminate terror. Traumatize the people. We're not killing Sandinistas in the capital. We're not blowing up their homes and terrorizing them. We're hitting at the people throughout the interior of the country.
In the early 1980s, when the CIA was working to establish a southern front in Costa Rica in the war against Nicaragua, a relationship was established with John Hull, an American rancher living in Costa Rica. There is mounting evidence that the airstrips on Hull's ranch became not only a delivery point for illegal Contra weapon shipments from the U.S., but were also used for transporting cocaine into the United States.
You have CIA bases in Costa Rica and Honduras. You have airplanes flying back and forth continuously, landing at bases in the United States where they don't have to go through regular customs, with the CIA escorting the people in and out in a certain laissez-faire in the attitude at best of the customs, if there is, you know, any customs representation there. So it's a dream situation for drug smugglers.
But CIA involvement in the drug business did not start in Central America. It dates back at least as far as the Vietnam War.
Well, the three men, Shackley and Singlaub and Secord, were all working together from different countries on the huge CIA secret war in Laos. our allies were the opium-growing tribesmen, and this meant that we continued in a very large way not only to support but really to augment a flow of heroin. This had to be run with the knowledge and the approval of the people who were in charge of these air operations. And these air operations had been controlled in the 66-68 period by General Secord.
The weapons trade and the narcotics trade in the world are two of the top five major money-making transactions in the whole world. These two major commodities in the world are hundreds of billions of dollars that go on. So the amount of money that we're talking about here is absolutely gargantuan. And all that the intelligence community, these guys have brought outside the governmental structures, are tapping into hundreds of millions, which they need to run their operations.
Do you think the Iran-Contra scandal will have an effect on future government operations?
No, I think it would be more of the same.
I don't think that it's going to have much of an effect at all. I just think that they'll be more careful next time.
They will continue to carry on covert operations. I think this has been going on forever.
They make laws which are for us that they don't seem to be able to, they don't apply them to themselves very often.
And who is going to inhibit them? The gangsters that are running this country is going to inhibit somebody.
What's happening here, my friends, is a major deception, which is in process as we stand and talk tonight. A major deception in the same way that the Warren Commission was a major deception worked upon the American people. The same way that the Watergate investigation was a major deception worked upon the American people. Just like the bombing, the secret bombing of Cambodia was kept secret and was a deception worked upon the American people. How long are we going to stand for being deceived in this manner?
Assassination, drug smuggling. If they had pursued that line of questioning, they would have soon gotten themselves into a position where they would have had to impeach someone. They could track that right back into the White House. They could put it at least right under the nose of Ronald Reagan.
This is the major constitutional crisis since the Civil War. You have a president who is unaccountable and says that it's his interpretation of what laws he'll select to obey. When you have that, you have a constitutional crisis.
Covert operations have never done this country any good. They may be of momentary advantage to the people who are in power at a particular moment, but in terms of the interests of this country as a whole, they have proven disastrous. There isn't a single one in 30 years that you can point to and say, well, that was one that we are now more secure, better off, and happier as a result of. Every one of them has in its own way contributed to the deterioration of security in the world that we live in. And so it's really time to stop them.
Instead of operating within rules and law, we have been supplying lethal weapons to terrorist nations, trading arms for hostages, involving the U.S. government in military activities in direct contravention of the law, diverting public funds into private pockets and secret unofficial activities, selling access to the president for thousands of dollars, dispensing cash and foreign money orders out of a White House safe, accepting gifts and falsifying papers to cover it up, altering and shredding national security documents, lying to the Congress. Now, I believe that the American people understand that democracy cannot survive that kind of abuse.
There was a time when ignorance made our innocence strong. There was a time when we all
in the late afternoon of December 4th, 1980,
an unmarked grave was found in a field in El Salvador. When it was opened in the presence of the U.S. ambassador, it revealed the bodies of four women. Mary Knoll's sisters Maura Clark and Edith Ford. Ursuline's sister Dorothy Kazel. And lay missionary Jean Donovan. Of the five officers later found responsible for the rape and murder of these women, three were graduates of the United States Army School of the Americas. The School of the Americas originated in 1946 in Panama. Now it is located on the grounds of Fort Benning, Georgia. The school teaches commando operations, sniper training, how to fire an M16, and psychological warfare. Since no major declared war between Latin American countries has occurred in decades, and the communist threat has vanished, why provide this kind of training? Representative Joseph Kennedy.
If you look at the course ranges that are offered to these individuals, they in fact are a dedicated way of teaching military leaders in foreign nations how to subvert their local communities.
Since it opened, over 55,000 military officials from 23 Latin American and Caribbean countries have trained at the school, about 2,000 students a year. As facts have emerged about the school and its graduates, it has drawn the attention of a growing number of human rights activists, such as Mary Knoll Father Roy Bourgeois.
Just down the road here is this school, the School of the Americas. It's a combat school. Most of the courses come around, revolve around what they call counterinsurgency warfare. Who are the insurgents? We have to ask that question. They are the poor. They are the people in Latin America who call for reform. They are the landless peasants who are hungry. They are health care workers, human rights advocates, labor organizers. They become the insurgents. They are seen as el enemigo, the enemy. And they are those who become the targets of those who learn their lessons at the School of the Americas.
What has been learned about the lessons taught at the school? In the 1980s, the civil war in El Salvador became a focal point for human rights activists throughout the world. Death squads operated freely, often killing 50 people a night. There were so many cases that on March 23, 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero in San Salvador made a plea to the military leaders of his country.
I would like to make an appeal in a special way to the men of the army. In the name of God, in the name of the suffering people whose laments rise to the heaven each day more tumultuous, I beg you, I ask you, I order you, in the name of God, stop the repression.
While celebrating Mass the next day, Archbishop Romero was assassinated. A number of years later, the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. made an important discovery when they obtained a copy of a declassified cable. Kate Doyle.
These two cables are both from the American Embassy in El Salvador. One is from Dean Hinton, who was then ambassador to El Salvador in 1981. And it discusses a meeting during which Roberto Daubuisson plans the murder of Archbishop Romero. During the meeting, there is described a lottery that the people who are attending the meeting hold to see who would draw the right to kill Romero himself.
Daubuisson was trained at the School of the Americas. Also trained at the school were two of the three officers directly responsible for the assassination. December 11th, 1981. El Mozote, a small village in El Salvador.
Primero llegaron y dijeron que todos salieran a la calle.
First, they forced everyone out of their houses and made us all lie face down in the street, both men and women.
Hombres y mujeres, boca abajo. Y los niños llorando. Los soldados estaban así.
There were soldiers on both sides. Then they moved away to see the women kneeling down on the ground to pray. They killed all of them. Not a single one of them survived. Just me, by the grace of God. I hid under a tree. When I heard the screams of the children, and I knew which ones were mine, they were crying, "Mommy, they're killing us."
Over 900 men, women, and children were massacred. Virtually the entire population of the village and the area surrounding El Mozote. Out of 143 bodies identified in the laboratory, 131 were of children under the age of 12, including three infants under the age of 3 months. 10 of the 12 officers cited as responsible for the El Mozote massacre were graduates of the School of the Americas. They were members of the Atlacatl Battalion, a part of the El Salvador Army. November 16, 1989, San Salvador. Six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her 15-year-old daughter were slaughtered. To get the facts about this incident, a U.S. congressional investigation began, led by Representative Joseph Moakley.
I went down, talked with the embassy, talk with the military, talk with the unionists. The killing was done by the Atlacatl Battalion, which is the crack battalion in that country. And these are the people, some of them had just returned from the United States, where they were taught a course on human rights, amongst other things.
19 of the 26 officers implicated in the Jesuit murders were graduates of the school. The United Nations Truth Commission report, released on March 15, 1993, cited specific officers for committing atrocities during the El Salvador Civil War. At School of the Americas Watch, just outside Fort Benning, Georgia, Vicki Immerman matched the names cited in the UN report with names in a United States government document.
What I did was I took these officers, all the officers listed in the report, and I took their names and looked them up in this list of graduates of the School of the Americas, which we received through the Freedom of Information Act. What I found were 49 of the 60-some officers listed were graduates of the School of the Americas.
El Salvador is only part of the school's story. In the entry area of one of its main buildings are photographs of those the school honors, its so-called Hall of Fame. At the top of the list, Hugo Bonzer, former dictator of Bolivia, a graduate of the school. Some of the others similarly honored are the former dictators of Honduras, Ecuador, and Argentina, and generals from eight other Latin and Caribbean nations, many cited by human rights groups for involvement in human rights abuses in their own countries. Among other graduates, Manuel Noriega, former president of Panama, currently in prison in the United States. Four of the five ranking Honduran officers who organized death squads in the 1980s as part of Battalion 316 are graduates. Half of the 250 Colombian officers cited for human rights abuses attended the school. The three highest-ranking Peruvian officers convicted in February 1994 of murdering nine university students and a professor were all graduates. During the dictatorship of the Somoza family, over 4,000 National Guard troops graduated from the school. Many of them later became known as the Contras, responsible for the deaths of thousands of Nicaraguan peasants in the 1980s. The general in charge of Argentina's so-called dirty war was a school graduate. During that internal conflict in the late 1970s and early 1980s, an estimated 30,000 people were tortured, disappeared, and murdered. General Hector Gramajo of Guatemala was the featured speaker at the school's graduation ceremonies in 1991. Human rights groups claim he is the architect of strategies that legalized military atrocities in Guatemala, resulting in the death of over 200,000 men, women, and children.
As a Catholic priest, as a U.S. citizen, I really feel a responsibility to speak out against that because of this. This does not lead to healing. It leads to death and suffering. In a way, this is a death machine. And this, I want to say, is very close to home because it's in our backyard. It's not out there in El Salvador. This is not in South Africa. We're talking about a school of assassins right here in our backyard being supported and financed through our tax money. It's being done in our name.
An amendment offered
on September 30th, 1993, the School of the Americas was debated by Congress for the first time in its history. It happened when an amendment to the Defense Department budget was introduced by Congressman Joseph Kennedy.
Mr. Speaker, my amendment would reduce the Army operation and maintenance account by $2.9 million, the amount dedicated to running the Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. The intent of this amendment is to close the school.
We're only 30 or 40 votes short of winning. That means that if people around the country hear about this and write their congressman, we can win. This is an issue that we can win on.
And what's very important right now, I feel, is to let our voices be heard. Bishop Romero said it best. Before he was killed, before he was assassinated by someone who trained at the School of the Americas, he said, "We who have a voice, we have to speak for the voiceless." And I realize that we here in this country, we have a voice. We can speak without having to worry about being disappeared or tortured or being picked up. We can speak. And I just hope that we can speak clearly and boldly on this issue.
I'm not very educated, but in my simple words, I think that the only thing the School of the Americas has accomplished is the destruction of our countries in Latin America. Don't give us any more of that military aid. It would be better to help the poor who are in need.
We need the voices of others, and we also need those letters to congressional leaders to let them know that we will not allow them to use our money to run a school of assassins.
Till now, the diagnosis is not settled for this child. Mm-hmm. He complains from prolonged fever and this wasting.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Worth it because she believes the sanctions are working.
In November 1997, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark headed a delegation of the International Action Center on his seventh trip to Iraq to investigate the continued effects of the United Nations sanctions on the population. We were shocked by what we saw, an almost total absence of medicines, medical supplies, and spare parts for the equipment. Despite the heroic efforts of medical personnel, babies, children, and the chronically ill continued to die in vast numbers. The United States government claims that Saddam Hussein is to blame for the crisis. What is the real cause of the suffering? The sanctions. They are an extension of the 1991 United States war against Iraq. The goal was to cripple Iraq's infrastructure and make civilian life unsustainable.
We demonstrated the capacity of technology to cripple a country without ever setting foot on it in the Persian Gulf. It's important to recognize that because it goes hand in hand with the sanctions. When we merely say that we flew 110,000 aerial sorties in 42 days, one every 30 seconds on the average, 24 hours a day, we ignore what we really did.
As officials said, the death toll was now 288, with many more to come. The trucks kept filling up and driving away past waiting relatives who knew they might never be able to identify the bodies of their loved ones. The community of Amaria filled one of the first of many funerals with gunfire in sign of grief and fury, and with angry words aimed through foreign journalists. "My mother, she's gone," shouted this young man. This woman asked, "Could not all your modern technology tell you that there were children and women here?" Bill Blakemore, ABC News, in the Amaria district of Baghdad.
We destroyed every silo for grain or anything else storing food in the whole country. We destroyed all the storage and processing of food plants throughout the country. Even dates, the world's biggest exporter of dates. Famous processing and packaging plants in Baghdad, deliberately destroyed. We didn't want them to be able to feed themselves for a long, long time. We're all aware of the famous little powdered milk plant.
The United States government says that in this factory here you are making chemical weapons. Is that true?
No, that's not true. They are lying. Because this is milk for children.
Uh-huh.
It's powder, milk of children.
Uh-huh. Nothing else was made? Only this in the factory?
Yes, and you can see in yourself.
With the only factory in the Middle East to produce powdered milk, they were producing about 17% of their powdered milk requirements. We destroyed that, cut off all the milk. And malnutrition of the mothers immediately jeopardized all of the infants. 70% of the pregnant women, even today in Iraq, suffer anemia.
The death rate for children has soared compared to 1989, the last year before sanctions. One of the biggest causes of death in Iraqi children today is diarrhea and dysentery due to the untreated drinking water. Iraq's water purification plants were heavily bombed in the war, and many that were repaired have broken down. The United Nations bans the import of spare parts and chlorine into Iraq to purify water. We saw the effects of this policy in the hospitals.
This is the second attack form of acute bloody diarrhea, amoebic dysentery. Most of them are due to contamination of water. He is malnourished, anemic, underweight, with a developmental delay.
Diarrhea and vomiting.
Do you have tap water there?
No.
You can see the conditions of these children shouldn't happen anywhere, and it's caused by the sanctions that the United States government insists upon.
The U.S. military used 800 tons of depleted uranium weapons in the war, causing a rise in cancers among the population. Why does the United States government spend $50 billion a year to patrol the Persian Gulf and keep Iraq locked down?
please raise their hand.
Why does it pressure the Security Council to maintain the total blockade?
We need to look back on the recent history of Iraq. For many years, U.S., British, and French oil companies owned 95% of Iraq's oil while they maintained a puppet monarchy in power. The people lived lives of extreme poverty. When the Iraqi people carried out a revolution in 1958 against King Faisal II, U.S. and Britain lost their stranglehold. They sent thousands of troops to the Middle East, but it was too late. Iraq had become a sovereign country. Iraq nationalized its oil and used the wealth to develop industry, modern sanitation, education, an excellent healthcare system, electricity, and highways. Iraqi women won new rights.
The United States wants to return Iraq to its earlier status as a virtual colony in order to secure its control over the Gulf region's oil, which is two-thirds of the world's petroleum reserves.
Our involvement in the Gulf is not transitory. It predated Saddam Hussein's aggression and will survive it. Long after all our troops come home, there will be a lasting role for the United States in assisting the nations of the Persian Gulf.
There are those that would like to lift the sanctions. I am not among them.
Our main objective is lifting the sanctions, which has been very, very cruel on our people.
Why do you think Americans want to keep the sanctions?
That's their policy.
Why do you think?
Let's ask them. That's their policy. It's against the will of the international community. It's against the will of many other countries. I think they are making profits from that. But I don't want to make accusations.
Financial profits?
Yes.
Like how?
Who is selling oil instead of Iraq? Iraq had a share in the oil market. That share was stopped by the sanctions. Who is selling that?
Who?
They know very well that Saudi Arabia jumped from 5 million barrels a day to 8 million barrels a day. 3 million barrels, the Iraq's share, have been added to the share of Saudi Arabia.
And we would take this to a war front to protect Saudi Arabia's making more money?
No, you are sharing that money. Everybody knows that.
Before the sanctions, Iraq used its $20 billion in annual oil exports to import 70% of the country's food and medicine. The cutting off of Iraq's oil by the Security Council has caused widespread hunger.
Starvation of civilians as a method of warfare is prohibited by international law. The sanctions are a violation of the Geneva Convention, the United Nations Charter, the Constitution of the World Health Organization, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of the States.
It's not France, it's not Russia, it's the United States which is imposing these sanctions, which are killing their children by the hundreds of thousands. And we believe that the right policy for the United States government is to stop the sanctions, and that the people of this country who are paying, having our tax dollars used to impose hunger and starvation, are not really being spoken for in this current
crisis.
But
the UN has backed these sanctions.
Well, the United Nations for the last 6 or 7 years has become virtually a plaything for U.S. policy, and that's because of U.S. dominance in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. That doesn't mean that the people of the Middle East or the people of the world really support U.S. policy.
Today's march that we're beginning now is a procession to commemorate the more than 500,000 children in Iraq who have died from the sanctions policy, a policy that's so linked. The growing hunger here in the U.S. is reflected 1,000 times in the starvation of more than 1 million people who died in Iraq.
I think it's very important that each one of you came out here today and to keep in touch with us and to raise your voice, to show your face, to stand and walk with the Iraqi people. We are thousands of miles away from them. But when I was in Iraq, I felt so desperately. I wanted to call the United States, and I wanted to say, sisters and brothers, organize a demonstration now. Get together, even if it's 25 people, even if it's 10 of us. Show that we are here in the United States, that they have friends here who do not believe in the extermination of the Iraqi people, that they have friends here who say...
The International Action Center has launched a major medical aid campaign to deliver medical supplies to the people of Iraq. Essential medicines and supplies can save the lives of many, many people. We are asking everyone who sees this video to join in making the Medicine for Iraq campaign a success.
Well, we all know, don't we, the reasons why the United States intervened in the Gulf the way we did. In the end, killing between 100,000 and 200,000 Iraqis, as opposed to 303, I think, Americans killed either in combat or in combat-related accidents. And we certainly have restored to power the legitimate authority in Kuwait. In fact, we've done it applying that age-old, all-American political principle of one man, one vote. In this case, one man, the emir, one vote, his. We heard Bush back in August, didn't we, at the very beginning saying that our way of life was at stake. We had to do something about that invasion of Kuwait. We also heard, didn't we, besides the way of life was at stake, we had to intervene to protect the access to the energy resources of the Persian Gulf. Another one was that we had to stop naked aggression. What we did not get are alternative interpretations of the events that occurred. And that's what I want to speak about here tonight. It's my opinion that the United States needed an international crisis, an international threat, to replace the crisis in Europe that largely disappeared with the collapse of communism and the chaos in the Soviet Union. Why? In order to keep the permanent war economy going, to justify continuing the situation wherein more than 50% of the federal budget goes to military purposes. Well, this means that the military expenditures in the United States are the motor of the U.S. economy, and they have been that ever since about 1950. It's worth reviewing the history because that's where this crisis, I think, comes from, this sought-for, needed crisis. In early 1950, there was extreme worry at the highest levels of the Truman administration that the United States was likely to return to the conditions of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so early in 1950, the decision was taken that this domestic economic problem was going to be solved through militarism, that is, through rearmament in the United States and through U.S. financing of the rearmament of Western Europe, particularly Western Germany. The document which provides the analysis of the world at that time and the U.S. place in the world and the internal situation in the United States was top secret for 25 years. In 1975, it was accidentally or through error released and published. It is known as NSC 68. It was written by NSC, standing for National Security Council. It was written by Paul Nitze, and it is a very detailed document. The main operative conclusion, though, was this. This is a quote from the document. The United States and other free nations will, within a period of a few years at most, experience a decline in economic activity of serious proportions unless more positive governmental programs are developed. Well, the solution adopted those more positive governmental programs was expansion of the military. But Truman could not get this program through Congress at first. There was opposition there and public opposition to the enormous new taxes that this program would require. He went on national radio, declared a state of national emergency, and said what Bush's remarks about our way of life being at stake reminded me of. He mustered all the hype and emotion he could, and Truman said, among other things, he said, "Our homes, our nation, all the things that we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union." In his speech, he also called for massive increases in military spending for U.S. and European forces, quite apart from the needs in Korea. Well, there was no threat from the Soviet Union. They were still rebuilding from the rubble of World War II, in which they had lost 20 million people. They were no threat, but they were manufactured from 1950 on, from the time of Korea on, as a grave threat to the United States. And that became the justification for this program, which Truman, through manipulation of the Korean War, had been able finally to get through Congress. The result was that in the first 2 years, that is the 2 years between 1950 and 1952, the U.S. military budget more than tripled from $13 billion in 1950 to $44 billion in 1952. And during the same two-year period, U.S. military forces doubled to 3.6 million people under arms. This was the beginning of the permanent war economy in the United States. The Korean War, by the way, went on for three more years after it could have ended. In the end, 34,000 U.S. were dead, more or less, more than 100,000 wounded, and the total casualty count was in the millions. It is worth recalling that because from 1950 on, the Soviet threat was the justification. The justification for the permanent war economy and the justification for these enormous military expenditures. What does that mean in far as the United States is concerned? Well, it means that we have not addressed or begun to solve the many domestic crises that we all know exist. There's no need really to go through this litany of the worst educational system in the developed world. One in three in this country illiterate, either totally or to the degree that they cannot function in a society based on the written word. Healthcare, not just the cost, but the fact that 40 million people in this country have no health insurance. The only developed country in the world with no national health plan. And on, the fact that only about, 60%, about two-thirds of the eligible voters register to vote. And of those who register, only about 80% actually vote, so only in the end, 50% of the eligible voters vote in national elections in this country. And that means that a president is elected with around 24-25% of the potential vote. The litany goes on, the environment, the infrastructure, finding a prevention and cure for AIDS, the violence we see everywhere and in every form in the United States. When you put all these things together, I don't think anyone would argue, add drugs, of course, anyone would argue that we have a domestic society in profound crisis. And the reason why, over all these years, these crises have not been solved is, in my opinion, because those who really control and rule the United States don't want them solved. Imagine what would happen if we had an informed electorate, if we didn't have the worst educational system, if we had a negligible, perhaps, illiteracy rate here. There might be an informed electorate. We might be debating real substantive issues in the electoral process or in the political process in the United States. There might be a threat in this country of real democracy. If we solved the domestic crises in this country, people might clamor to participate if there was a real debate. There might be a threat of a third party, I mean a second party, in the United States. There are all kinds of threats to elitist control of the United States if we were to solve these domestic crises, in my opinion. And it is for this reason that we have always needed this foreign threat and this foreign crisis in order to justify putting the money into military expenditures instead of converting the economy once and for all to human purposes. During those 40-odd years of the Cold War, the CIA has been a very important factor or tool or instrument of the President of the United States in waging what is continuing today. This new world order of George Bush, or new international order, seems to me to be nothing more really than the institutionalization of the North-South dimension of the old Cold War, that is the war against the Third World for control of their natural resources, their labor, and their markets. That is where the fighting really took place, as in Vietnam. This North-South dimension of the Cold War, the war against the Third World, continues today as we sit here with all its racist content. And we and our allies, that is the United States and its allies, are just as dependent, if not more, on the resources of these countries in the Third World as they ever were. And that dependency is not going to disappear. It's going to keep on growing through the years. So what I think Bush has in mind is, through this Persian Gulf crisis, to send a message to any aspiring Third World leader that Third World radical nationalism will not be tolerated. It is a way in which, in fact, we are beginning to treat the Third World, or continuing to treat the Third World, like we treat Third World people right here in the United States. They know their place, they have a role to perform, and they are expected to do it. If they don't, if they make trouble, they're going to be smashed. That is what happened, of course, with Iraq. I believe that Bush encouraged the Hussein administration and Saddam Hussein himself to believe that they could get away with taking over Kuwait with impunity. And there are many signs that point in this direction. Iraq never really formally recognized the independence of Kuwait. They have always claimed that Kuwait was part of Iraq taken away by British imperialism, which is indeed the case. Last April, Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly testified before Congress that the United States had no commitment to defend Kuwait. On July 25th, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, meets with Hussein. Among other things, the U.S. ambassador says to Hussein, "Mr. President, I have a direct instruction from Secretary of State Baker to emphasize to you that the United States has, quote unquote, no opinion on your disputes with Kuwait, particularly your border disputes with Kuwait." She also said, "I have an instruction from President Bush to seek better relations with Iraq." President Hussein, in response, in several places, says that what Kuwait is doing through its overproduction is the equivalent to war against Iraq. They are destroying the Iraqi economy, he said, and we are going to take strong action. He as much as said that they were going to go to war. Well, in this meeting, with those 100,000 troops on the border, not one word from the U.S. ambassador of warning to Hussein not to invade. Well, put all those things together, and you have to ask yourself the question, why did the Bush administration do nothing during that last week between the ambassador's meeting with Hussein and the invasion itself to prevent that invasion? They knew those 100,000 troops were there, but not one word from Glaspie to Hussein about it. My conclusion is that they wanted the invasion, that this was the site selected for the new international crisis that would justify continuation of the war economy in the United States. It was totally avoidable, objectively speaking, but because of the tradition in the United States, after all, we are a warrior culture, we do still live in the age of imperialism, and the demands of this system require this crisis. I go back to the CIA for just a moment because it's worth recalling that the agency from the very beginning of the 1940s, was used not only to collect intelligence from around the world, process it, and present it to policymakers like the President for their decisions, or to help them in their decisions. Obviously, that's what an intelligence service should do. But the CIA was used all through these years to subvert the democratic processes of other countries. At the very first meeting of the National Security Council, which was set up in the same law that established the CIA as the National Intelligence Service, this was October 1947, 1 month after Truman signed this bill into law, establishing the CIA and the National Security Council as the highest policy-making body in national security and foreign affairs. At the very first meeting in October 1947, the decision was taken to set aside $10 million for the CIA to intervene secretly in the Italian elections coming up about 6 months later. The CIA was not just used in these electoral operations. You know, the media operations were vast, and I'm sure they still are. Media operations basically means that the CIA pays a foreign journalist to publish the CIA's material as if it were the journalist's own. There were CIA interventions of all sorts, but one area I want to mention of special importance are what are known as liaison operations. Liaison operations are all those activities that the CIA undertakes with the intelligence and security services of other countries. Early on, the CIA began to set up security and intelligence services in other countries for purposes of internal security. One of the first places was Greece. There was a civil war, you know, in Greece in 1947 to 1949. The United States intervened on the side of the far right in Greece, and the U.S. side won. In the aftermath, the CIA set up a security service known as the KYP, or KEEP, KYP being the Greek initials for CIA. They gave it the same name. This security service was used to keep the far right in power in Greece for nearly 20 years. But when that power was threatened with upcoming elections in 1967, the CIA and this service, this KYP, organized a military coup in Greece, which was successful, leading to 7 years of military dictatorship in Greece, of neo-fascist stripe. During that period, torture became an institution in Greece. Thousands of Greeks were forced into exile. I could give you many, many examples of this. In Iran, for example, in 1953, the CIA undermined the elected, democratically elected civilian government of the day, of Mohammad Mossadegh, overthrew that government, installed the Shah as military dictator, and in the aftermath set up a service called the SAVAK. This service, over the 25 years of the Shah's regime, became famous for its torture chambers and its assassinations of the Shah's political opponents. 1954, the U.S., the CIA, intervenes in Guatemala, undermines the civilian government, the government is overthrown, and from 1954 on, Guatemala has had one succession of military rulers after another, a military dictatorship. In the aftermath of this operation in 1954, the CIA set up an internal security service, and then others. But from these services set up and supported by the CIA all through the years, came the death squads. In other words, the services established by the CIA then spawned these death squads in Guatemala. The very same thing in El Salvador. You can be as sure as you are of your own name that for the last 10 or 11 years, the CIA has been working in there day and night with those Salvadoran security services and military, collecting information, giving it to those services, which in turn are the same things as the death squads, information on activists in the human rights field, the student leadership, trade unions, and so forth. And those have constituted the 75,000 or so people who have been murdered over 10 or 11 years in El Salvador. Disappeared, many of them, others tortured to death, their bodies thrown along the sides of the roads. Nobody knows how many have been killed in Guatemala by these military regimes, which started with the CIA. Some say 100,000, some say 125,000, some say 150,000. Who knows? Nobody will ever really know the exact number who have been killed. But you multiply this around the world, because I'm only mentioning a couple of examples of these CIA operations. There have been now 44 years of this, and they have existed all around the world. And put those operations together with the overt military interventions and the enormous cost in human life of those, such as Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Vietnam, for example, all of those, and you get the picture of this expansionist, extremely aggressive U.S. foreign policy. Well, I don't think it's enough really to describe what the CIA does or U.S. foreign policy in general. It's also necessary to ask a couple of questions. And going back to the Gulf for just a moment, consider this analysis of what really happened in the Gulf. You know that the United States has been exporting war materiel for decades, beginning right around 1950 with the document I mentioned earlier. Tanks, guns of every sort, weapons, planes, ships, and military equipment of every sort. Well, with a national debt of $3.5 trillion in this country, $800 billion of it owned by foreigners, for handling of that debt, it seems that it was only a matter of time before the U.S. armed forces were sent abroad as one more export. Because what we did in the Persian Gulf crisis was to send abroad that enormous amount of military hardware, but this time we also exported the people to operate it. It was armed forces sent abroad to protect the resources and the regimes, these family dictatorships of the sheikhdoms of the Persian Gulf. What we did, in fact, was what we in the United States do the best. We made war, and we were financed in this exercise by the people who make things that people around the world want, cars, VCRs, and so forth, financed mainly by the Japanese and the Germans. And that puts the United States, as it's going to have a permanent presence in the Persian Gulf, in a very strong position vis-a-vis the Japanese and the Germans, who are not there militarily. And they are going to depend to a great degree for their energy resources, at least from that region, on U.S. policy. That is why they went along with the war. That is an interpretation of the Gulf crisis. And the other question that I wanted to raise is why we do these things as a country. Why we do these as a society, as a nation. Why do we do these grisly things abroad? I believe strongly that until we have fundamental change in the United States, domestically, in the domestic system, until we have some kind of real democracy in this country, participatory democracy, where people have a say, and where we end the re-election of 95 to 97% of incumbents at every election, where there is a real political debate, until we change the domestic system, we're going to have elitist control of the United States, we're going to have these foreign adventures and the grisly things, as I mentioned, that the CIA does abroad. So the real problem is here at home, in changing the domestic system, in bringing about a conversion of the economy to human purposes, solving the domestic crises, and getting the people out of office who are in there to back a continuation of the permanent war economy.